You're listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next, Guns and Butter.
This is Guns and Butter.
Something happening, yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
What it is ain't exactly clear. There's a man with a gun over there.
At the end of the day, when I was finished with the certain parts of the investigation, it was clear to me that there's no way PTAC could have done all of this without a lot of inside help. And that's what I began focusing on, that it was a cutout, that it was a front. Was it a regular CIA front? Was it a clandestine front? What was it? You know, there are walls within the FBI, walls within the CIA, behind which these operations take place. And who is behind those operations, you know, is a key question.
I'm Bonnie Faulkner. Today on Guns and Butter, Indira Singh. Indira Singh worked on Wall Street from 1975 until June 2002, when she was summarily terminated due to her investigation into computer software company, PTEC. On 9/11, Indira Singh was working as a senior consultant for J.P. Morgan Chase. She was tasked with developing a next-generation operational risk blueprint, which would proactively identify exposures, including money laundering, rogue trading, and illicit financing patterns. It was in this capacity 9 months later that she sought to subcontract with software engineer PTEC to design a next-generation risk blueprint for J.P. Morgan Chase. Today's show, Ground Zero 9/11, Blueprint for Terror, Part 2. In Part 1, she described her work as an emergency medical technician at Ground Zero and began to describe her professional work for J.P. Morgan Chase and her first client meeting with software engineer PTEC. So, Indira, how did your meeting with PTEC, how did that go?
Well, they came a little late. Immediately, there were some issues with how the day would proceed. For instance, they showed up without the agreed-on software in hand. The most important thing about it is that their chief scientist, Dr. Hussein Ibrahim, came. He's an Egyptian-American, and he had a very good reputation in the field, very bright, someone you would like working with, very knowledgeable. But they had showed up without the software, and what I had done was isolated a workstation, took it off the net. After all, we were testing whether the software would meet our criteria, and if I had said it did, then that would be a big deal if it subsequently couldn't. So I needed to start with an out-the-box version of PTEC. They didn't bring that, and Dr. Ibrahim said, that's not a problem. We can develop the demo on his laptop. And if you know anything about these things, that's like a no-no, because at the end of the day, he's walking out the door, and I don't have anything. And he's walking away with pretty much enough of how we're thinking about doing operational risk. Now, operational risk is about how to spot bad things that are going on in a financial institution, things like rogue trading, money laundering, and so on and so forth. And it's very subtle. Our intellectual property, at least what J.P. Morgan was hiring me for, was to think innovatively out of the box for the next generation. How do you proactively design a blueprint to spot these things? And that's pretty big. He's definitely, people are smart enough to get an idea, oh, they're thinking of going down this road. That's a big deal. So I was a risk person, so I'm very aware of not to expose our intellectual property or that of the company I am consulting for. I'm very protective of that. So they showed up without the software, and that was a huge enough red flag that I began paying attention to them. A couple other things went on, and within half an hour, I just walked over to the same people who had recommended them and began calling, and I said to one of them, I have the PTEC people here. And the reaction was not the reaction I would have ever expected. It was, what are they doing on site? And I said, well, you recommended them. And they said, no, you should have come through a distributor, an American distributor. And I said, J.P. Morgan reserves a right to work directly with the company, and besides which, they are a preferred vendor of IBM, their preferred vendor program, and that's the way we work. We don't work through small distributors. If we're going to go with this software as a standard, we're going to go right to the source and make the agreements there. So I said, what is the problem? And basically, this person said, don't let them out of your sight. And that's when my stomach sank. So you have to understand how all of a sudden I'm beginning to see these people in a different way, because when they said, don't let them out of your sight, I have a Middle Eastern company there, and we're taught not to discriminate, and that was not something that I was about to do. And to prove that they were there being evaluated. So that is never, going to be a bone of contention, although later people made that an issue. But if I had a problem working with the Middle Eastern company, they would have never been there in the first place, much less before Ground Zero closed. And no problem whatsoever having them up there. I like the idea.
What do you mean PTEC was a Middle Eastern company?
Well, that's what subsequently was revealed in the phone call, that their financier, their funders, their investors were all Saudis. And I said, so what? And they said, one Saudi has been placed on the U.S. terror list October 12, 2001. And I said, it got very quiet. I said, you better have proof of that, because having thrown that into my lap now, this is not something that I can ignore. I have to follow up on it. This is not something I can ignore or pretend would go away or have someone else handle. This is risk management at the highest levels of one of the largest banks in the world. It is my responsibility to deal with this. And I said, how can I get proof of this? And that's when they started saying, you need to talk to Jeff Goines, who was one of the only three people in PTEC who knew of this relationship. You see, it was that well hidden within PTEC. And so I subsequently called Jeff Goines and I said, well, if this is true, did you not report this? PTEC is a private company, so this relationship would have been privy only to those on the inside. I said, did you report it anywhere that someone who has been placed on the U.S. terror list is key funder, angel investor to a company whose software is utilized at the highest levels of almost every government and military and defense organization in this country, including the Secret Service, the FBI, the Department of Defense, the House of Representatives, the Treasury Department, the IRS, the U.S. Navy, the U.S. Air Force, and last but not least, the Federal Aviation Administration.
Are you saying these were all PTEC clients?
These were all PTEC clients, and when I was evaluating them, I was pretty impressed. Why not PTEC? Exactly. They're being used at the highest levels of all of these organizations. So I was very excited about using them and having their software be able to be at the heart of what I wanted to develop. And I had no reason to believe that if they were in use everywhere at that caliber, that I would have a problem. And they're also used in Enron, perhaps. I should have thought twice about that, but they're at use in IBM, of course, and the top accounting firms, and even in the FBI, in MITRE.
What is MITRE?
MITRE is a large company that does specialized technology for defense and intelligence. You would not expect to have an exposure with a company that was so well entrenched and embedded in these kinds of organizations.
So what about the meeting? Then did they leave? This what
no,
happened?
No, because basically my position was until I had proof, I could not react. That would have been very unprofessional of me. And so I thought of a number of scenarios that could be going on at that point. I thought it might have been, you know, competitiveness, out of control, distributors wanting the JP Morgan account. It could have been anything. However, the one thing that was true is that the chief investor, Sheikh Yasin Qadhi, was indeed placed on the U.S. terror list, because while I was talking to them, while they were still there, I checked out a website that had a list of everyone who had been placed on the terror list. The missing piece was, of course, proving that Sheikh Yasin Qadhi was indeed affiliated with PTEC, was an owner of PTEC, because it was a private company. You could say that anybody was an investor, any bad guy or good guy was an investor. Proving it was another thing. So I let everything ride, but I kept an eye on things. And in fact, we did have a presentation that went very, very well, because in no way, shape, or form was I going to jeopardize that.
So what happened next? Did you go on working with them, or did you start to investigate PTEC?
Well, I continued multitasking. I was working with them. I placed a few phone calls, and people got back to me later that day while they were still on premises. So I was able to separate the concerns, accomplish the task, evaluate the software anyway, start the phone calls to start getting more information. Then my report would have been, this is a software, it's used everywhere, it can do what we want it to do. However, we have this issue with the company, and present that to my superiors and let them decide.
Then did you start investigating the company?
Yes. What happened next was I spoke with Jeff Goins, and he told me that basically not only was Yasin Kadi was an investor, but that a Yakub Mirza was on the board of directors, and he had been the subject of Operation GreenQuest. Many of his Herndon, Virginia vehicles and companies and financing companies had been raided in March 2002. And again, that Mirza was on the board of directors. As we spoke, other names started to come out. My head was pretty much spinning at this point, and I said, have you reported any of this to the FBI? And the answer came back, yes. So I wrote a report to the FBI, and I said, okay, if the Boston FBI has been told, I need to speak with people there, because it's not just my group that's evaluating them, it's so many other groups. But I couldn't believe that if this was all true, that PTAC was still being used by the Department of Defense. There's something a little bizarre about all of this. And really, I was beginning to understand unwillingly that the world was not the way we thought of it.
Now, this person that you were discussing this with, Jeff Goins?
Goins, yeah.
Was he an employee of PTAC?
Yes, he was. He's one of the key people at PTAC. He held several important positions. He had traveled to Saudi Arabia, and he had met with Yasin Kadi, and he had met with most of the investors. His last position was vice president of sales, which for a small company is pretty significant. He worked with PTAC, helping build the company for 5 years, and he was the one that was based in Virginia, who was responsible for getting a lot of the government accounts. With, of course, Osama Ziadi, who was the president. Osama Ziadi is a Lebanese-American who, according to Jeff, got a citizenship under very questionable circumstances, which involves the INS. Now, this is all according to Jeff, so at some point later in the week, I had decided to go down to Virginia and meet with not only Jeff, but a number of other PTAC and ex-PTAC employees, because this was beginning to sound like a Tom Clancy novel, and I needed proof. I told them I needed emails, I needed documents, I needed hard evidence. But in the meantime, within a day or two, I had contacted my rep at IBM, and I said, I need to walk outside with you and talk to you about something. If you guys are thinking of getting seriously in bed with this company, I would suggest that you do some background investigation so that your clients like JP Morgan and myself don't end up in the situation. His name was Kyle Hilligoss. Kyle told me that he quote unquote wrote a book report and sent it to his legal department, and he was told to just back off the whole thing. In fact, he would don't want to have anything to do with me as I continued investigating. Jeff did get the agents at the FBI, the Boston FBI office, to call me back. And with Kyle listening in, so it wasn't just me reporting on what Jeff had said, we spoke to the FBI agent who had picked up the information that Jeff had reported on PTAC when Yasin Kadi was placed on the terror list in October 2001. Remember, this is 8 or 9 months later. So my question to him is, if you have an investigation that's ongoing, that's fine, and we don't want to get involved with it or impede it in any way. But in the meantime, this country's infrastructure is seriously exposed, and I cannot, if any of this is true, cannot, and I need some evidence, something that you can give me to hang my hat on it when I report this, that this is true, that this isn't just someone making a terrorism report, you know, that you know that this is true. And basically what he said is, Indira, you're in a better position on the outside to get the proof that's needed than I am. And I asked him to check with his supervisor. I said, do you understand how serious this is to have a company with this alleged terrorism connection at the highest levels of corporate America and the U.S. infrastructure? And I said, if you don't know, we need to make you aware of this. He apparently went to a supervisor, and his supervisor said that the position wouldn't change. And the Boston FBI office, you can check this out, was rated as one of the worst in terms of corruption, and I believe the Whitey Bulger incident. The connections between the FBI and the mafia have been, how should I put it, extremely well explored in the Boston FBI office. The ex-governor of Massachusetts, I believe, anyway, this mob character, Whitey Bulger's brother, was in a very high-level political position in Massachusetts and Boston. And in fact, if people were to read Peter Lance's book, Cover Up, he explores it very well and backs up a lot of what I had found here, the interaction between organized crime and the FBI. So when they said they weren't going to proceed, I...
And by they, you're talking about the FBI.
The FBI. I said, I need something to hang my hat on. And so he sent me a videotape. And the videotape, which I have here, the substance of the videotape was a news clip. It was a news clip of a CBS affiliate based in Boston called WBZ-TV. And their investigative reporting team, the I-team, which was led by investigative reporter Joe Bergantino, had investigated a number of Middle Eastern men who were sought after 9/11. They were affiliated with Muslim Islamic terrorism financing charities. He had created this clip to show the connection between the 9/11 terror attack and the financial vehicles that were supposedly used to fund it. And what he did was very interesting. He connected, the I-team connected CARE International, not the big CARE International, but something called CARE International that was based in Boston, all the way back to Al-Kifa, which was the financing vehicle at the center of the World Trade Center bombing in 1993, all the way back to something called Maktab al-Khidmat, which means the office, which was a financing vehicle that was set up by the CIA for the Pakistani ISI back in the days when Osama bin Laden was America's fair-haired boy and was on our side fighting with the Mujahideen, fighting the Soviet Union. So the question to me was, my goodness, when I saw the videotape, what is Maktab al-Khidmat doing being run out of PTAC on 9/11? And the reason I say being run out of PTAC is that the faces in the videotape were the faces of core employees at PTAC. Now, remember, this is a small company. There were only one or two people who had access to the source code in PTAC, and that is a very trusted position, and he was one of them. His name is Suhail Laher. The people who started CARE International, some of them were actually on an FBI terror watch list prior to 9/11 in Boston.
What do you mean by the source code?
Well, all software products has some group or organization or person writes code that is then packaged up. And, for instance, the word processor in your desk, the spreadsheet, and so on and so forth, the browser, is all written in some sort of code. Those are the keys to it. And if you wanted to improve it, add new functionality, you would change the original code and add new functionality and then repackage it and send it out there. So whoever had access to the source code of PTAC, that was where the value was. If you'd lost the source code, you essentially lost the product for all intents and purposes from a marketing point of view. So only one or two people would have access to the source code. It would be like having the formula for Coca-Cola, basically.
Now, let's go over that a little bit again. Now, you were talking about the CARE International and some other funding groups that have been, what, funding international terrorism?
That's correct.
And also have been funded by what, the CIA?
Well, the roots of Al-Kifa and CARE International, if you look at it, were way back in the late 80s, around the time of Iran-Contra, for instance. Maktab al-Khidmat was set up so that monies could be passed to Osama bin Laden and the Mujahideen when they were fighting the Soviet. Now, I won't go into a lot of detail, but it ended up that Osama bin Laden took that over and was running Al-Qaeda through that. The connections to the Pakistani ISI still stood. The connections to the CIA still stood, not in the way that was originally set up, but through a black or a gray operation that had been later confirmed to me. At the end of the day, when I was finished with certain parts of the investigation, it was clear to me that there's no way PTAC could have done all of this without a lot of inside help. And that's what I began focusing on, that it was a cutout, that it was a front. Was it a regular CIA front? Was it a clandestine front? What was it? You know, there are walls within the FBI, walls within the CIA, behind which these operations take place, and who is behind those operations, you know, is a key question. Now, people might say, oh, this is all conspiracy theory, but I would like to remind people that conspiracy is very much recognized by the United States Federal Code, and it's called RICO, racketeering and influence, and it is very much recognized because there's so much power in these organizations that they have rules in place. For instance, the DCIA, the director of CIA, cannot, after his term of DCIA, subsequently run for vice president or president, which is what happened with George Herbert Walker Bush. That rule was bent for him. He went on from being the DCIA to running for vice president. That's a no-no.
I'm speaking with 9/11 whistleblower and risk technology architect Indira Singh. Today's show, Ground Zero 9/11, Blueprint for Terror, Part 2. I'm Bonnie Faulkner. This is Guns and Butter.
Well, it sounds like you're describing an interlocking relationship then between this software company, funded by Saudis, and funded by whomever, the United States government, U.S. corporations, and then known groups globally that are accused of staging terrorist attacks. Absolutely. It's all of a piece.
Yes, absolutely. There, and one of the things that I want to say is maybe those organizations don't fully know who their masters are. And PTAC is the one thread, the one golden thread you pull on. All of this is unraveled because it goes into the corporations. It goes into government entities. It goes into the terrorism financing entities that none of which have been, oh, by the way, taken to task. And there are just so many questions about what does this all mean? And as I investigated further, we found that the origins of PTAC were very interesting. Where did this company come from, obviously, is the first question. And how did they get to be so powerful? Who were the people? Who were the organizations that brought them in? Who knew? Who gave them the power? Who, for instance, signed off Ziadi's U.S. citizenship without doing background checks? Who said that they had a bad feeling doing that? Who gave them influential... I remember that PTAC's competitors, U.S. companies, were extremely annoyed at the fact that they could not get equal time, that all the plum contracts were going to a foreign-owned company. And I said, well, did you know they were foreign-owned? And if they're foreign-owned, they couldn't get certain classified projects. And he said, Indira, everyone knew. Some of the competitors said everyone knew that that they were Saudi-owned, and that meant that they got favorable treatment in Capitol Hill. And I said, well, are you saying that they just got favored treatment, or if there was something more going on, they wouldn't answer? Their lawyers instructed them not to answer. So they knew a lot of what was going on.
Who were you talking to about this?
Well, in one particular case, I was talking to one of their competitors, Popkin Software. And, you know, I have no problem naming names because I think that in the memory of 3,000 U.S. civilians and worldwide civilians who were murdered, if we are going to wage wars and spill blood around the world, we ought to take a look at this and just have the truth come out, because the truth has not come out. There's been a lot of speculation. There's been a lot of innuendo, but there hasn't been hard proof. And PTAC is the one situation where you can get hard proof. When we investigated PTAC and the people behind it, where they came from, we found out that one of the founding members was a man by the name of Solomon Beharry. He was one of the founding directors, and he had put together a vehicle called BMI, which stands for Baitul Mal. Now, BMI was, you know, identified as being involved with terror financing, but this is just not going to be the Muslims hate America. That's not what it is. There is something else going on here. They're being used as a tool, just as the good people of the United States are being used, are being misled into and frightened and terrorized into, if we don't wage these horrific wars, you know, our way of life will be over. Who benefits from that?
What else did your investigation of PTEC turn up? Didn't you meet with several employees or former employees of PTEC?
Yes. It goes back to when all of this was being revealed to me. Now, this is the last week of May 2002. The last day, or June 1 or so of 2002, lo and behold, out of nowhere, the Chicago FBI enters the picture. We have Agent Robert Wright, the Chicago FBI, who's giving congressional testimony, and he stands on the steps of the Capitol, bursts into tears, apologizes to the 9/11 families, victims, that he didn't do everything he could to prevent 9/11 from happening, that his investigations were repeatedly shut down. And I almost fell over, because he announced that his investigation was the investigation into Yasin Qadhi, this same Sheikh Yasin Qadhi who was the money man behind PTEC. And you could not ask for a more direct connection to 9/11 than that. I will even discount the fact that some ex-PTEC employees told me that when I went to see them, I presented all the terrorist faces and whatever, and they had indicated that they had seen some pass through PTEC. In fact, one or two had mentioned that they thought one of the hijackers had actually passed through PTEC. And I said, did you report this to the FBI? Can you tell me when? Can you get evidence of it? Can you get litigation quality evidence, something that would stand up? Whatever you can get, give it to me. Make copies. Give it to the FBI. I still thought they were on our side.
The FBI, you mean?
The FBI, in fact, and this has to be made very clear, there are some extraordinarily real patriotic Americans and good people in the FBI, as has been said by, I believe, Agent Colleen Rowley, one of the FBI whistleblowers' bosses, that there's a wall in the FBI. And this has been validated to me by various attorneys in Houston who are very close to the power bases and are pretty ticked off at what's happening in this country and are speaking out, as are many CIA agents who are very concerned that it has gone too far, as are many NSA agents who are concerned that it's gone too far, and FBI agents. So we have a lot of people who are speaking out. They've kept quiet too long. They're afraid. They're afraid of what's happening to this country. And when I say the Third Reich, what is happening to this country, they say, and I will identify they, if pressed, they say, will make the Third Reich look like a tea party. I guess we have that many more billion people to control on this planet.
And when you say they say, are you referring to people that you've spoken with in the FBI?
Absolutely. Within the FBI, then the CIA. One of the things I didn't want to have happen is that when PTEC was finally raided in December 2002, something that took all of 6 months, a tremendous amount of agony to have happen, the White House, Ari Fleischer, spun it to find sugar that day. He said, oh, there's nothing wrong. Nothing here, nothing to see here. Everything's fine. So they did a token raid, and that was basically it. But everything that I have done since that time has been for one reason and one reason only, that there may come a time that people will find the trail to PTEC, and it won't be hidden or buried. I've kept it alive. Whether they renamed their company and moved on, I want to keep the names, the details, everything alive, no matter what I have to do, so that should there come a time for justice and accounting for 9/11 and for what's happening in the world today, it makes it easier for other people to unravel the truth. So I have gone to the mainstream press. I've gone to people on the left of left, on the right of right. And I've talked to them face to face and said, this is wrong. Whatever your political inclinations, this is wrong. This is criminal. This is murder. This is worldwide atrocity. And I have reached some very good people on the left and on the right who are willing to speak out about PTEC. I've contacted the alternative press. The alternative press has, like, very much like the nine blind men and the elephant, they touch a piece of PTEC, they understand it, and they say, well, this fits my theory of how things went wrong. I have no problem with that, because the facts are the facts. If someone wants to spin it to fit their particular viewpoint, for instance, from the wilderness, has said that, well, the software that's in PTEC is very much like PROMIS, the Prosecutor's Management Information System, that was has a whole cargo cult behind it of these legendary capabilities. Well, maybe back in the 80s and 90s it was legendary, but today you can do pretty amazing things with software. It's not a big deal. But anyway, from the wilderness and Mike Rupert, for instance, thesis was that Dick Cheney was running an alternate command and control center that day, confusing everyone. And in fact, there were four war games that were going on 9/11, and who knows why the fighters weren't scrambled in time. Who knows all of this? In fact, the fighter to Pennsylvania was scrambled in time because we have firsthand proof, you know, whistleblowers within the correct organizations that that was shot down. You know, it's just that Let's Roll was a better story, perhaps a story that the American people could handle. But no, I was told at Ground Zero that day, we heard them go over and we knew they were shot down. We were told it was just later that we were told, well, the passengers brought it down. Well, if you're running a country and you're really under terrorist attack, that might be the way to go. Empower people by saying, if this bad thing happens to you, get up and do something and have a story. I really don't have such a big problem with that, but the fact of the matter is it was shut down.
Oh, and that's interesting. And you heard that on the day of September 11th.
Yes, I did. And it was corroborated a couple of weeks ago by people who were in a particular situation room.
Did you want to say anything more about that?
Well, it is possible that there was an alternate command and control system that could you technically use PTEC software to do surveillance and intervention? Well, gosh, yes, that's exactly what I was planning on using it for in one of the largest banks in the world. It's not a problem. So if someone wants to make it their thesis, I have no problem with that. However, I can't say for sure that that was going on because I don't have direct firsthand, you know, knowledge of that. No one has told me and offered me proof of that. But could I state that it could happen? Absolutely, it could have happened. Was it necessary for it to have happened in order for us to have a 9/11? I don't know. I don't think so. Maybe, maybe not. That's not my point. The towers came down, 3,000 people were killed. And what I know is the characters behind the funding of it were totally in bed with characters in the United States, and not only just for 9/11, but going on throughout our nation's history. And the big question is why? What are they up to?
Could you describe the relationship of PTEC with the FAA? Now, PTEC worked with the FAA for several years, didn't
yes.
they?
Yes, they worked the FAA. There was it was a joint project between PTEC and MITRE, and they were looking at, it's interesting, they were looking at basically holes in the FAA's interoperability with responding with other agencies, law enforcement, in the case of an emergency such as a hijacking. So they were looking for the escalation process, what people would do, how they would respond in case of an emergency, and find the holes and make recommendations to fix it. Now, if anyone was in a position to understand where the holes were, PTEC was, and that's exactly the point. And if anybody was in a position to write software to take advantage of those holes, it would have been PTEC.
Explain what interoperability is.
Most people are familiar with eBay, and you know that it's a collaborative bidding situation. You bid for a particular item, a certain amount of time passes, and the winning bid is selected according to certain rules. And once the winning bid is selected, then something else happens. Then something else happens. The thing is bought, and then it's taken down off eBay. Well, these are a sequence of steps that occur. It's a process, and it's a process that a lot of people are familiar with. So everything we do involves a process. Now, if eBay had one huge, gigantic computer, these processes would take place on one computer. However, interoperability comes into play when you jump computer systems or organizations. So, for instance, what if eBay had to pass on some information to PayPal? PayPal is a separate operation. They have their own computers. So they have to come up with a way to handshake, to agree on when this happens at eBay, so-and-so will happen on PayPal. That's all interoperability. So it happens on a business process level, and it also happens on a system transaction level. Hey, you know, PayPal says, hey, well, you send me this in this format, I'll expect it, and then do this with it. That's all interoperability. It operates on a technical level, on an information level, and on a business process level. Now, with the FAA in particular, if something goes wrong and there is an emergency with a particular flight and the Department of Defense needs to be notified, well, that's a really major interoperability thing. A signal has to be sent in some way, shape, or form, either mediated by a human in most cases or automatically. Or even if it's mediated by a human, something has to be initiated on a separate computer to start a whole other sequence of events, intervention, scrambling a jet, notification up and downstream with many other organizations, such as NORAD, such as other terminal radar areas, such as local law enforcement, such as you name it. So this all has to be blueprinted, mapped out, and that's where enterprise architecture comes in. You need some kind of blueprint to keep all of this together, and that's what PTEC was so good at.
Now, was there a reference to PTEC having operated in the basement out of the FAA?
Yes. Now, typically, because the scope of such projects are so overarching and wide-ranging, when you are doing an enterprise architecture project, you pretty much have access to how anything in the organization is being done, where it's being done, on what systems, what the information is, and you pretty much have carte blanche. Now, if it's a major project that spans several years, the team that comes in has literally access to almost anything that they want because you're operating on a blueprint level, on a massive scale. So, yes, they were everywhere, and I was told that they were in places that required clearances. I was told that they had log-on access to FAA flight control computers. I was told that they had passwords to many computers that you may not on the surface think has anything to do with finding out holes in the system. But let's say you said, okay, you isolated a part of a process of a notification process that was mediated by a computer and you wanted to investigate it further, then you would typically get log-on access to that computer. And from that back upstream or downstream, so who knows? You know, from my own experience, I could have access to almost anything I wanted to in JPMorgan Chase. And didn't, for the reason if anything went wrong, I didn't want to have the access. But if you were up to no good as an enterprise architect with such a mandate, you typically could have anything you wanted, access to anything.
What do you think of the claim by the so-called 9/11 Independent Commission and the testimony before it in their report? The intelligence agencies didn't know how to talk to each other. What did you think of their so-called report?
Completely flawed. Governor Kaine was the second choice for the head of the commission. I believe Henry Kissinger was the first. Governor Kaine had, oh, by the way, done business deals with BMI, Solomon Behari, PTEC, none of which came out, which he should have volunteered and either recused himself as being ahead or have it out there in the open. There were three other members of the commission who had similar kinds of relationships in the past, and they were all on the team. But their findings were so flawed. They're using an excuse. Yes, there are interoperability communication issues in any organization. Yes, they are. But in the case of an emergency, it doesn't get that bollocksed up. Unless, of course, Rupert is right and Cheney was running interference somewhere or someone was running interference or whoever. You know, we don't know. But there were four war games, four simulations going on the morning of 9/11. And I just want people to remember that the whole nature of what MITRE, which is also they develop software for intelligence, which includes the CIA, MITRE, and PTEC, would have, if they were going to test whether they had fixed these holes, would have probably run a simulation. I don't know that they did, but that's how we do things. But there were four of them going on. So was there room for confusion? I don't think these people were stupid. I think they were deliberately confused, if anything.
Well, we know very well that there was a simulation of the very event taking place during the event,
yes.
Right?
Yes, there was. And I believe there's proof there was more than one, just in case the first one didn't confuse people enough. So what does this say? I can be very objective about this and say, well, the terrorists knew that there were war games scheduled for this day and they took advantage of it and called 9/11 the particular day. However, we do know that 9/11 had been selected prior. Okay, so then maybe the war games were set many weeks prior for 9/11. And you can play this game over and over and over. Yes, it was the perfect day. And yes, you needed inside knowledge. And yes, PTAC with all its myriad associations would have had the inside knowledge. And yes, PTAC was a CIA front. And yes, a PTAC was protected. So was it an inside job? You don't have to look at this indirectly. This is direct. This requires direct investigation.
I'm speaking with 9/11 whistleblower and risk technology architect Indira Singh. Today's show, Ground Zero 9/11, Blueprint for Terror, Part 2. I'm Bonnie Faulkner. This is Guns and Butter.
Well, that was what I was going to ask you about your investigation of PTAC. You have pretty much come up with evidence that, of course, PTAC was a CIA cutout or front or whatever.
That's correct. I had this validated to me by high-level people within. And in fact, during my investigation, when I was reaching out to the people that I had worked with, because remember, I did do work for a small company called the Interoperability Clearinghouse, or the ICH, and they were DARPA funded. And they weren't a DARPA company, they were DARPA funded. They got funding from many, many organizations, including Boeing and whatever, because they were providing a wonderful service, software. And we were seeking funding from InQtel, which was the IT seeking arm of the CIA. Now, when interestingly enough, the funding decision was supposed to come through on September 12th. I am not saying that it would have come through, but after 9/11, there was no funding coming through on 9/12. So subsequent to that, I was picking up the pieces and still remaining in contact with that group and trying to form another group and company while I was working at JP Morgan after 9/11, while we were going through the environmental nightmares that we were going through. I was still trying to pick up the pieces of that life to create a really good risk blueprint to prevent the kinds of things like 9/11 from happening to us. And I was pretty ignorant about a lot of this inside clandestine betrayals. What happened, I kept in touch with a lot of these people. When PTAC fell into my lap, I did reach out to them. I said, can you tell me if what I'm looking at is true, is real? How could it be real? And one of the people that I reached out to did work for the CIA, and he said he could not discuss front office operations. And I never knew what he meant by that. But anyway, subsequent to that, there were two or three points down the road that I had higher and higher level confirmation that it was being utilized. Eventually, I came across a report, actually the FBI, Twin Towers investigative report, that the FBI had commissioned a private investigator to do on certain people. And in there, it was so clear that, I mean, even the presence of CARE International, whose roots were in Maktab al-Khidmat, that was glaring. And that they were all over every place in U.S. infrastructure. You do not get that without very high-level help. And that's what the vendors, the competitors of PTAC, had said. Everyone knew. They were given carte blanche, open.
And this was a separate company in Washington, D.C., that you were doing some work with prior to September 11th.
Right.
That got some funding from DARPA.
Right. Interestingly enough, I did not let people know that it was PTAC until maybe August 2002, this ICH, the DARPA-funded group. No, we had pretty much moved on. And I accidentally let slip in August 2002 to one of my colleagues there that the company, the name of the company that was being investigated was PTAC. And she was horrified, because she said, they're everywhere. And I said, yeah, fancy that. Wonder who put them there. They didn't get there by accident. PTAC came about in 1993, actually. They were reformed in 1993. That's when Yasin Qadhi had invested in them.
What happened with the raid that the FBI staged on PTAC?
Well, what happened was, when I took all of this information back to J.P. Morgan, after Agent Wright had appeared on the steps of the Capitol, then I went down to Virginia. I got all the information together. I had the PTAC people actually write it out. So it wouldn't be Indira says, it would be, this is what they put together. And I had emails, documentation, photographs, the photographs that flew around the world that was plastered all over network TV. That's what I got from these people. And I interviewed a bunch of very scared people. What is going on? The FBI knows about it and they're doing nothing. What is going on? What do you think this tells you? And I didn't want to go there without proof. I wasn't going to go there. Really what I did, and the most powerful thing I think anyone can do, is not just to make an accusation or get a little bit of proof, which can be hushed up and denied, but I took what I had to everyone. Before PTAC was ever raided, before it ever became public, I took it all the way up to the top of the FBI. I took it everywhere. And the reality of the situation is proven by the response I got there. More telling than the actual deed itself, their response to that is really what indicts them all.
What was their response?
Shut up and go away or you will be killed. Basically.
Now, you got that response from all different levels in government.
I got that response from JP Morgan. I got that response from PTAC. I got that warning from people within the FBI, mostly the FBI. See, when the Boston FBI sent me that tape that Joe Bergantino had run the story on, and I looked at the tape and it was all PTAC people that, you know, basically are affiliated with PTAC that they were looking for, I was really scared. And I contacted Joe Bergantino to tell him I've been threatened. People have been in my house. I'm a 9/11 survivor. I can't back down on this. And that if anything happens to me, the story that you did back in December, November 2001, did you know that these people worked at PTAC? He said, we had some suspicion we didn't know. And I said, well, let me tell you what PTAC does. When I went down there and I spoke to them in June 2002, they thought I had a flower pot growing out of my head. They didn't believe me at all. I said, you've done the original story. You just don't realize they're connected to corporate America and the government in this way. So what they did is they initiated their own investigation. And their own investigation, they came back to me and said, we're sorry for having doubted you. It's not only as bad as you said, it's much, much worse. And they said...
And this is the investigative reporter.
Right. Their whole team. This is CBS, oh, by the way, and a CBS affiliate. So they had interviewed me and taped me, and this is now August 2002. They had said that we are going to run the story on the 1 year anniversary of 9/11, and I begged them. I was horrified. Please do not delay. Get it out now. And they said, no, it's not going to play well in August because everyone's on vacation. And I was banging my head against the wall. I was in tears. And I said, they're going to shut this down. People are going to talk, they're going to find out about it, and they're going to shut you down. And sure enough, they did. There were seven networks that had caught wind of this story, and they shut down the investigation. Their excuse was that, hey, you know, yeah, PTAC is everywhere. We don't want them to be. All of a sudden, they said, you know what? We have to find out that if we do anything to them, what will they do with our infrastructure? Which was complete baloney because they had known all along. And they were, even as I spoke out at that time, they were being evaluated for use in homeland security.
You're talking about PTAC.
PTAC, yeah. So much for their little trite little excuse about, oh, yeah, gosh, we let this one slip through for like almost a year, you know, but now that we're aware of it. See, and that's why, in my making other people aware of it, they were aware of it at the highest levels all along. So they can't suddenly pull that and say, well, you know, they could impact national security if we suddenly raid them. They were being evaluated for use in homeland security. So we knew it was a cover-up at that time. And I was very concerned that they weren't ever going to raid PTAC, that no one would ever know. This would never be made public. If I had spoken out about it, I could be sued. Where is your proof? You've told the government they've done nothing. You've told the FBI they've done nothing. I then embarked on my own campaign. I had written a report, and I had a pretty good email list of people in D.C. And I said, you know what, I'm going to send this report exposing PTAC and their connections to terrorism to 10 chief information officers, chief technology officers, a week until PTAC is raided. And I began calling people. And I began sending things out. I began scheduling appointments and showing up instead of talking about enterprise architecture. I was talking about, well, what software do you use? And I watched more people's face turn absolutely white. I watched people almost get physically ill. And I watched them circle the wagons. And I'm talking about major chemical companies, major energy companies, and the CIO, one of the CIOs of the Department of Defense, whose Pentagon meeting I interrupted to talk about PTAC. Yeah, the line went dead. But within a week after that, PTAC was raided, and Ari Fleischer said there's nothing wrong with the company. I watched my life go down the drain. But
so what about PTAC now? I mean,
I apologize. They're still in use. They're still going. Absolutely, but they've renamed themselves. They're called Go Agile, and they're still going. Nothing. When we try to find out what the status of the investigation is, we've been told alternatively that they've been cleared or it's still in limbo. Nothing definitive has been done. Solomon Beharry had been arrested. Minor slap on the wrist.
And what kind of a response did you get from J.P. Morgan Chase, your employers at the time, when you went to them with what you had found out about PTAC?
Well, they had told me that I should be killed for getting all this evidence. I was intimidated. I wrote a letter to my boss saying that I had been intimidated, and the person who intimidated me, the third highest ranking person in the bank, the general auditor, had said this has gone all the way up to the top, and they were very aware of it, and that they were going to explicitly deny PTAC being used at J.P. Morgan Chase. In fact, they would even explicitly deny the URL to the website so that no one could even look into them. Of course, now the name has changed, so we wonder what's going on there. But when he asked me, where did you get this from and that from, I was basically thoroughly intimidated. They treated me as though I was a bad guy. That's what happened. They treated me as though I was a bad guy for having dug up all of this stuff.
And you were told by the chief auditor at J.P. Morgan Chase that the different individuals that you had gotten this information from should have been killed?
Yeah, yeah. And you have to remember that I pointed to down the street. I said, I lost people there. And he said, I lost people there too. Look, you know, this is about 9/11. I put it in a folder labeled 9/11. And it got pretty ugly from that point on. Basically, he said that if he needed to be sure that I would never mention PTAC again. And I said, here's a problem. I'm a senior consultant. I consult with a lot of people. You may deny PTAC business here. What happens to Citibank? What happens to Goldman Sachs? What happens to the rest? He said, that's not my problem. And I said, that's why we have that hole in the ground up the street. It is everyone's problem. In fact, Director Mueller of the FBI said that preventing terrorism was everyone's problem. So, you know, I'm just going along with an FBI directive to the general population. And so I had written a letter to Wilson Lowry, who at that time was his right-hand administrative person, who was an ex-CEO of IBM, Wilson Lowry. Wilson Lowry turned out to be the one who came down hard on Colleen Rowley for being a whistleblower. So guess what his politics were on PTAC.
As a senior consultant with J.P. Morgan Chase, were you on a consulting contract or were you an employee?
No, I was on a consulting contract. However, I had a 10-year relationship with them. I was given tasks there that were not given to employees, to even trusted employees. I was given responsibilities way above and beyond a lot of other employees. I was given pretty much carte blanche to think out of the box and do things. And I was funded out of a strategic fund called Lab Morgan, where they experimented with new ideas. So I had a lot of latitude, and the people I reported to were on the board of directors and very senior level. They trusted me, keeping their best interests at heart. I think exactly my behavior around a PTAC was entirely predictable and in line with someone who held a light for risk and integrity in business dealings. In fact, one of the colleagues said, of all the people who's left this would fall into, you're about the only one with enough latitude to not look the other way.
And so then what happened? Was your contract fired. Your contract canceled?
Summarily terminated.
You were?
Yeah.
And when did that happen?
June 28th, 2002.
And you stayed on in New York City then through 2004?
Right. I stayed on in the same apartment. I reached out to friends of mine in the FBI who I asked them what was going on. I got pretty close with one of them who understood who was on the counterterrorism team, the Northeast, and was part of the A-team, so to speak. And he looked at what I was looking at. I passed a lot of my information through him, and I said, am I crazy? Please tell me that I'm crazy. I'd rather be crazy than this be true. And he said, nope, and it is worse than you think. So he validated a lot of things. He could not break any rules, and I wouldn't let him because he was my friend. But he helped me see and interpret things. So one of the most powerful things I could have done was to push this through the system and see how the system responded. And it's the system's response that indicts them in the end, just as the system's response to the EPA, to the environmental disaster in Lower Manhattan, indicts them. If this were a true terrorist attack, you would have been seeing pictures of our lungs all over national TV for years to come, metaphorically, that sort of thing. You never saw what it was really like. So basically, after I got thrown out of J.P. Morgan, my attitude was, as soon as everyone knows what PTEC really is and they understand that it was for real, all will be forgiven and I will be back in business. And that sure didn't happen. And I'm not sure even at this stage whether I want to be involved with anything to do with corporate America or the government, because look at what's happening. I'm looking at the people that are being put in place, like Negroponte, director of Intel. I'm hearing the inside response to that. I know where he comes from, what his pedigree is politically. And one by one, we're seeing the handwriting on the wall, and most people are looking for exit strategies. You might say leave the country, go to France, go to Canada, but there are no exit strategies for this. All of this stuff took money to fund, and it was funded through major financial crimes, money laundering, and looting. We call it looting, looting of the SNLs, looting of the banking system, and what we're in the middle of now, which is the looting of Social Security. And this is all being done, the looting of HUD, it's all being done systematically to keep the slush funds up for the game at play.
Where do you think this is headed?
Not any place good for people. And it isn't just going to be America, it is going to be global.
Well, Indira Singh, thank you very much.
Thank you, Bonnie.
Something happening, yeah. What it is ain't exactly clear. There's a man with a gun over there.
I've been speaking with 9/11 whistleblower and risk technology architect Indira Singh. Today's show has been Ground Zero 9/11 Blueprint for Terror, Part 2. Indira Singh is a private pilot and a climber. Prior to 9/11, she volunteered as a civilian emergency medical technician until she was injured at Ground Zero. This interview with Indira Singh was recorded in person in April of 2005 at night in the KPFA studios in Berkeley. At that time, she was conducting an investigation into PTEC. Guns and Butter is produced by Bonnie Faulkner and Yarrow Mako. Email us at faulkner@gunsandbutter.org. Visit our website at gunsandbutter.org, where this and other programs are archived.
Hey, yo, these are some serious times that we live in, G. And our new world order is about to begin. You know what I'm saying?
You're listening to Radio Free Radical. Your online antidote to corporate media crap.
Listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next,
New World Notes.
Welcome to New World Notes, hosted by Kenneth Doust. Today, it's the energy news, with stories and analysis by yours truly, Bruce Dixon, David Rovix, and even the New York Times. I hope you'll stay tuned. This started out as one of our odds and ends shows. And, as usually happens, the odds and ends cluttering the closet shelves of my mind turned out not to be random after all, but in fact pretty closely connected. This would come as a surprise to me, except I've gotten used to it at last. Just one of those quirks of my mind. Randomness keeps slipping away when I try to grasp it. So our show this week has a theme after all, and that theme is energy news. The biggest energy news since the Gulf oil disaster is Shell Oil's announcement that it is giving up its project to drill for oil in the Arctic off Alaska. That announcement came the end of September, and Greenpeace immediately claimed victory. I hate to be a party pooper, but I personally don't see any victory here. New Englanders may recognize the Arctic drilling news as very similar to the Vermont Yankee news. Vermont Yankee is a decrepit nuclear power plant that has been menacing the health and safety of New Englanders for decades. It's just upstream from here, near Burlington, Vermont. It's falling apart. Its pipes are weak and corroded. It's had accidents aplenty in recent years, and its corporate owner was determined to milk every possible penny of profit out of the plant. For years, environmentalists had been trying and failing to get the thing shut down. Even the Vermont legislature tried and failed to get the thing shut down. "The public be damned," said the plant's owner, Entergy Corp. Then, about a year ago, Entergy Corp itself decided to shut the plant down. It did so for the only reason that really matters in corporate America: the plant wasn't making enough profit. Strictly a business decision. And now Shell Oil has shut down an even bigger menace, for much the same reason. Here's the story from the New York Times. Shell exits Arctic as slump in oil prices forces industry to retrench. Dated September 28, 2015. As oil prices have continued their steady decline this year, rig after rig has been shut down, costing thousands of jobs in the United States. Yet, major oil producers have been loath to pull the plug on their most ambitious projects. Until now. On Monday, Royal Dutch Shell ended its expensive and fruitless 9-year effort to explore for oil in the Alaskan Arctic. A $7 billion investment. This is another sign that the industry is trimming its ambitions in the wake of collapsing oil prices. Shell's announcement was hailed as a major victory by environmentalists who had fought the project for years. But at the moment, global markets are glutted with oil thanks to new drilling techniques. The industry has cut its investment by 20% this year and laid off at least 200,000 workers worldwide. Companies also have retreated from less profitable fields in the North Sea, West Africa, Louisiana, and North Dakota. American oil companies have decommissioned more than half of their drilling rigs over the past year, and production is beginning to drop in the United States. Even exports from Saudi Arabia are beginning to decline because of a glut in its Asian markets. The price of oil has fallen more than 50% since last summer and is now below $50 a barrel. With demand dwindling, the current market of 94 million barrels a day has roughly 2 million barrels in surplus supply. The proposed Iran nuclear deal could lower oil prices further when more Iranian oil enters the world markets. Sidebar comment, so now you see another reason for the huge opposition in Congress to settling our differences with Iran peacefully. If we stop pretending Iran is the arch enemy and we lift our economic embargo, then more Iranian oil will be available. The price of oil will go down further, and the profits of the big campaign contributors our legislators were born to serve, specifically the profits of the big oil companies, may well decline a little. Conflict in the Middle East is good for McDonnell Douglas, but it's even better for ExxonMobil. So let's not hear any more loose talk about negotiation and treaties. Back to the text. The article continues. With Arctic drilling, economic forces have now scuttled what environmentalists had tried and failed to do for years. Quote, "This is a victory for everyone who has stood up for the Arctic," said Annie Leonard, executive director of Greenpeace. Continuing the quote, "There is no better time to keep fossil fuels in the ground, bringing us one step closer to an energy revolution and sustainable future." Unquote. ConocoPhillips and the Norwegian oil giant Statoil had earlier suspended their Alaska offshore drilling operations. Shell's $7 billion Arctic drilling project has been plagued by blunders and accidents involving ships and support equipment, reaching a climax in the grounding of one of its drilling vessels in December 2012. Shell also announced that the one Arctic well it had drilled this summer was not rich enough in oil and gas to warrant the high cost of further exploration. So ends the New York Times account by reporters Clifford Krause and Stanley Reed. I have edited and condensed the article a bit for radio. Hey, in the Times article, did you catch the name of Greenpeace's new head? Annie Leonard. Yes, it's Annie Leonard, the filmmaker. In years past, we've played the soundtrack from a few of her short films, including The Story of Stuff and The Story of Bottled Water. Well, good luck in your new job, Annie, and more power to you. But I have to disagree with your victory speech. "This is a victory for everyone who has stood up for the Arctic," said Annie Leonard. Well, to my jaundiced eye, not really. It looks more like another victory for capitalism and market forces. And when oil prices get above $150 a barrel again, I think we'll be gazing off the Atlantic coast and saying, "They're back." Mock my words. as my father used to say in his Boston accent. Mock my words. But enough about me. There's more good energy news, and the good folks at Black Agenda Report had a nice take on it. Commentator Bruce Dixon notes that we should be grateful for a recent energy and environmental decision made by President Obama. But, he says, let's not forget that overall, Obama's record on the environment has been very, very bad. Here's Bruce Dixon.
President Obama announced his plan last week to slash U.S. carbon emissions by 2030, mostly via EPA rules, which will effectively prohibit new coal-fired electric plants. This is unambiguously good news, especially from a president who once declared himself in favor of clean coal. The bad news is that the Obama administration could have done this in its first weeks in office rather than half past its seventh year, and it does not begin to redeem Obama's climate change legacy. The bad news is that the U.S. still leads the world in water-polluting, earthquake-causing fracking, in taxpayer subsidies to the fracking industry, and in the export of fracking technologies, for which the Obama administration has been a tireless advocate. The bad news is that when the Deepwater Horizon disaster, the largest known gas and oil spill in history, occurred in 2010, the Obama administration actively colluded with oil companies to lie to the public, concealing the volume and the extent of the leak. President Obama had the U.S. Navy and Coast Guard ban civilian overflights of the spill area, and local police agencies bar civilian access to affected shorelines, apparently to prevent independent experts from assessing the extent of damage and the speed of which the poisonous discharge was settling to the seafloor. The Obama Justice Department even protected British Petroleum by declaring that the damage awards could only be assessed against BP's holding in the U.S. Gulf, rather than against its global assets on six continents and oceans across the planet. But although the president's party controlled both houses of Congress for another 6 months, President Obama and his party sponsored not one piece of legislation, not one administrative rule to rein in the plundering activities of big oil. The bad news is that despite past disasters and future dangers, the Obama administration continues to issue new permits for drilling up and down the Atlantic and Gulf coasts, and is even permitting deep water offshore fracking. What could possibly go wrong? The bad news is that the Obama administration, just like the Bush and Clinton ones before it, has continued the bipartisan American tradition of subverting and destroying international accords on climate change, giving the final coup de grace to the Kyoto Accords, and condemning hundreds of millions in Asia, Africa, and Oceania to suffer the ravages of climate change. The bad news is that the Obama administration's equivocation on the Keystone Pipeline seems transparently calculated to get his party through the 2016 election, after which it will almost certainly be approved whoever is elected. The Obama administration has even issued permits for drilling in the Arctic Ocean, accessible for the first time in hundreds of thousands of years due to the melting of polar ice caps. Actual leadership on climate change would set a near-term goal of 80% to 90% of U.S. energy needs to be met by renewables like wind and solar, an end to fracking on land and sea, and the banning of offshore drilling, especially in the Arctic. Climate change leadership would be applauding the citizen activists who are delaying the departure of Shell's mammoth Arctic drilling rig from the port of Seattle. Climate change leadership would have the U.S. look more like Germany, which, although it's as far north as Canada, derives most of its energy from wind and solar power and other renewables. At this point, climate change leadership would mean popularizing the case for leaving the coal in the hole, the gas beneath the grass, and the oil in the soil, while we fund and find other ways to power our agriculture, our cities, and our lives. But none of that is part of the Obama legacy on climate change, which is pretty words, but ugly actions. For Black Agenda Radio, I'm Bruce Dixon.
Barack Obama. Remember him? As you may have noticed, campaigning for the 2016 elections is already underway, hot and heavy. Remember the 2008 election campaign? Remember what a joy it was to vote for Barack H. Obama? Or at least it was a joy to many progressive people I know. This was a joy I did not share. But the 2008 election followed 8 long years of George W. Bush and his blatant, unapologetic, and successful assault on practically everything you valued: democracy, peace, civil liberties, government of law, the Bill of Rights, even the English language. To say nothing of geography. He referred to Africa as a country, and he said that the national language of Mexico was Mexican. Let's not forget his indefensible destruction of Iraq, based on transparent lies that kept changing every couple of weeks. Then, on a white horse, comes Barack Obama out of nowhere. I mean, in 2006, had you even heard of this guy? 2 years later, he's elected president. In the campaign, he promises to make the American government good and decent again. He will restore the rule of law, end government wiretapping of its citizens. He will enact real health care reforms, and the centerpiece of the reform will be the option for single-payer open to every citizen. He will prosecute corporate criminals who crashed the world economy, and he will provide relief to the millions of Americans who lost their homes and their jobs in the crash. And his first official act as president will be to close the obscene prison and torture chamber at Guantanamo Bay, island of Cuba. So he promised. I think that, at heart, the American people really are a good and decent people. And after 8 years of Bush, we yearned for what Obama was promising. We wanted our government to act morally and certainly legally. We yearned for decency and democracy. We yearned for an end to the needless wars that Bush had started. And we voted for Obama overwhelmingly. Americans in general did, I mean. We ignored the many red flags, the many warning signs that this story was too good to be true. In November 2008, despite still more Republican vote rigging, Obama won decisive popular and electoral majorities. Not only that, but his political party, the Democrats, won large majorities in both the House and the Senate, which they held on to for 2 years. With a huge popular mandate and control of both houses of Congress, Obama devoted his first 2 years in office to doing what? To seeing that Wall Street banks got reimbursed by the taxpayer every penny that they lost through destroying the world economy. And incidentally, the working class and the middle class and the poor got practically nothing. Also, Obama immediately put the brakes on health care reform, making very sure that single-payer would not be an option. He expanded spying on citizens and refused to prosecute the corporations for illegally conniving in it. He increased U.S. military violence abroad. He said that his first official act would be to close the prison at Guantanamo. Well, 7.5 years later, the prison is still in business. Do you believe that the commander-in-chief of the armed forces does not have the power to close one military prison? Are you disillusioned yet? In 2009 and 2010, it was sad seeing many of my liberal friends profess their continuing belief that Obama was really a progressive liberal. Just give him time to get organized, they said. Then our liberal savior will emerge. You'll see. 2010, they said. Oh, Obama is just biding his time. Wait until after the midterm elections. 2011, they said. Look, Obama really is on our side, but the Republicans are just stopping him from acting like his true self. It was a sad sight. So many progressive people insisting that Obama really was a liberal. Insisting that, like Clark Kent, any day now, Obama would strip off the costume and reveal his true liberal self. Insisting on this, despite all the evidence to the contrary. It's sad to see a dream slowly disappear. And it was sad to see so many of my friends very reluctantly give up their hopes and dreams at long last. And they were good hopes and dreams, too, worthy ones. I don't feel at all good about being proved right about Obama. I'm as broken-hearted as anyone. Not disillusioned, as I never shared the illusion, but broken-hearted anyway. At least these days, so far as I can tell, nobody has any illusions about President Hillary Clinton or President Jeb Bush, as the case may be. Jeb Bush. Does anyone even know his real first name? What's Jeb Bush's real name? Does anybody even know that? Come on, it can't be any worse than Obama's middle name, and we knew what that was before the election. What's Jeb Bush's actual name? No, it's not Loretta. I will tell you. His name is John Ellis Bush. Remember, you heard it here first. But I digress. Okay, no more looking to politicians for salvation. How about some more good news? If salvation is to be had, it won't come from the politicians, but possibly from the people. Here's an upbeat contribution from David Rovix. It's about energy and about what the people can accomplish to make the world better. In Denmark in the 1970s, in the Jutland Peninsula off the North Atlantic, some more or less everyday people stopped an attempt to build a nuclear power plant, designed and built the biggest wind power turbine in the world, and gave the patent rights to the public domain. Here's the story.
At the same time as they were going nuts building highways around the U.S. and to a somewhat lesser extent all over Europe and elsewhere in the 60s and 70s and 80s, they were also building nuclear reactors all over the place. All the countries that could afford to were doing it, pretty much. Denmark being an exception. And the exception was the cause of a mass movement. Just like the highway here. It was in the 1970s. The fuel crisis had begun. The choices were presented to us as if we had none. Leaders of industry say that they could solve the problem by mastering the power of the radioactive atom. Some folks in Western Jutland got a notion in their heads. They thought there might be something they could offer up instead. A few hundred people gathered at a little place called Tvind and declared their will to harness the power of the wind. We're gonna build the biggest windmill in the world. We're gonna build the biggest windmill in the world. Some of them were scientists, the vast majority were not. But they knew with years of effort, you could do a lot. Word about the project spread far and wide. 100,000 visitors came to help and to advise. Until one day these windmill builders drove in with a crane and lifted up their giant wings with a mighty chain. We're gonna build the biggest windmill in the world. We're gonna build the biggest windmill in the world. When Twincraft was completed, it reached up to the sky. Its wings churned in the air at 54 meters high. The critics all fell silent. No one now was jeering, as even industry agreed. This was some damn fine engineering. The wind regaled Jutland from the North Atlantic Sea as it was seamlessly converted into electricity. It was power for the people, leukemia for none, when they declared in Denmark, just south of the midnight sun. We're gonna build the biggest windmill in the world. We're gonna build the biggest windmill in the world. They gave away the patents. They said knowledge should be free. And their plans were copied by a newborn industry. Soon Denmark would be known as a windmill-building nation. And it all started with some hippies at the Twincraft power station. Debates were held in Parliament about which way things should go. Build a nuclear reactor, the majority said no. It could have gone quite differently. In much of the world it did. Except for those in Ulfbo who said we're getting off the grid. We're gonna build the biggest windmill in the world. We're gonna build the biggest windmill in the world. We're gonna build the biggest windmill in the world. We're gonna build the biggest windmill in the world.
Ending our energy show on an upbeat note, that was David Rovix. He sang at a rally in Boston in January 2013. That very good live recording was made by Boston's invaluable Chuck Rosina. Thank you again, Chuck. And thank you, Loretta, or whatever your name might be, for listening to New World Notes. On the web, you'll find an archive of almost all our past shows, plus links, pretty pictures, and whatnot, at newworldnotes.blogspot.com. From Darkest Connecticut, this is Kenneth Doust, wishing you the best, advising illegitimi non carborundum, and hoping you'll come back again next week. Ciao.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical. Your online antidote to corporate media crap.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next, 9/11 wake up.
Hello, listeners, and welcome to this edition of 9/11 Wake Up Call. I'm Cheryl. Today you'll hear the second part of an interview between author Rebecca Roth and radio show host Henrik Palmgren of RedIceRadio.net out of Sweden. It's been edited slightly to fit in our time frame. Rebecca Roth is a retired flight attendant, international purser, a volunteer firefighter, and has been trained as an emergency medical technician. Her book, Methodical Illusion, came out this past year and was number one on Amazon for historical fiction. The book deals with 9/11 from a flight attendant's perspective. Since writing the book, many people in the airline industry have contacted her and shared experiences and information. So she has new information that you don't want to miss about what happened. And she's done many, many interviews. And you can access some of them by going to YouTube and searching Rebecca Roth. The second edition of her book, Methodical Illusion, is already available. The second part of the interview starts here with a question from radio show host Henrik Palmgren.
Now, let me ask you a bit more about the flight attendants and their part in this, then, if they knew what was going on. Because one thing that always comes up with me when we talk about these false flags and sting operations and people are dragged into things, sometimes knowingly, sometimes they don't know what's going on, etc. But in this case, I'm always curious as to why allow, do you think, some of these mistakes? Were they made at the time and they were not intended to be made, but there you go, there they are? Or is there another reason for that?
I've had lots of people from American Airlines come forward and talk to me on the phone and through emails. And most of them knew the crew members involved, both the pilots and the flight attendants. And this is what we've came up with. Remember, on 9/11, there were several military war games going on that day with the U.S. military. And we believe that what more than likely happened, there were not Arab hijackers on any of the manifests. So the real manifest, not the cooked up, made up stuff that the FBI has been lying about, but the real manifest didn't have Arab names on them. Those hijackers were not listed as passengers. So the handlers that came on, we believe, and I'll tell you in a little bit how the planes were taken over remotely, what was used to do that. The aircraft were actually equipped with a device that was sold to some commercial carriers in the United States, not all of them. Listen carefully to how it was sold. Quote, in the event that a hijacker took over control of the cockpit, we could land the aircraft remotely. And there it will be liberated by the Army Rangers, Navy SEALs, or whoever was nearby to liberate the plane and the passengers. So now you're probably wondering, well, then if they had that on board, why didn't they use it? Because certainly on 9/11, we had four airplanes where we are led to believe that hijackers had actually taken over the cockpit, right? Well, they didn't use that because it was already in use. And when the flight termination system, or one of the airlines actually referred to it as the flight interruption system, this is very interesting because the CEO of the company that created the flight termination system, it's the same system that we run our drones around the world in. They're using this flight termination system software. And that's how we can sit in Nevada and guys can fly our Predator drones and the like in Afghanistan and Pakistan and all those places where we're bombing wedding parties in elementary schools. So that's how they work. And the interesting thing about that, it's created by a company called SPC, like Sam, Paul, Charlie, SPC Corporation. The CEO of that company was also the comptroller of the United States Pentagon, Rabbi Dov Zakheim. Rabbi Dov Zakheim was, at the time of 9/11, involved in an investigation where the Pentagon had misplaced $2.3 trillion, with a T, United States dollars. And so He's very connected to a lot of other things. What I found about this rabbi, he's a dual citizen with Israel and the United States. Somehow he managed to become the comptroller of the United States Pentagon. SPC had a subsidiary company called TriData. And after the 1993 bombing of the World Trade Center, if you'll recall, his company TriData got the blueprints for both the North and South Tower. Very convenient. And then he also is involved with another group, a consortium of people, and they have another interesting company that refurbishes commercial 767s and turns them into military refueling tankers and sells them to military around the world.
I just want to mention that if this had been any other nationality of dual citizens and what have you, this would be immediately, wouldn't be allowed to begin with, but it would be immediately out in the open. But it's not on this case for some reason. It's hushed up, covered up, and no one is mentioning about it. And as you say, if you bring it up, well, you're an anti-Semite, right? So
yes, and just much like that person who questioned Building 7 falling down. And so one of the things that I made my decision when I decided I would do interviews after the book came out and talk about what I did find is that I'm going to tell you the truth. I don't care whose religion it offends, and you can call me all the names you want, because the truth is going to stand, and I'm going to stand in it. And the truth is the only thing that'll set us free and lift the veil of lies that the media, very, very controlled media, has been covering up for over a decade. And on behalf of the flight crews that perished and the passengers on those planes and every person that died in those towers, I'm going to stand here and shout the truth from the rooftops until they take me out with a drone strike or worse.
Very good.
I have no fear of them. So let me tell you a little bit about that flight termination system, because this is really important that people understand. The flight termination system ran on a frequency, much like the transponder. And so when the flight termination system took over the aircraft, and this is why a lot of the pilots in the United States Airline Pilots Association did not want this ever to be put on their planes. They lost all communication. It was an override system that overrided all communication, including being able to speak to the flight attendants in the cabin. Keep in mind that the cockpit door only has a little tiny peek hole, and we are their eyes and ears. If they don't hear from us, they don't think anything's going on. If the airplane is on fire in the tail section or in the cabin, they don't know about it until we phone them. So nobody wants to lose communication with their eyes and ears, and they didn't. And so only some of the airlines actually bought those. And just another interesting thing your listeners can look up, and readers, if you'd blog this too, is that Boeing actually got caught putting the flight termination system on a Lufthansa aircraft, maybe more than one, and also for a Chinese aircraft. They were Boeing aircraft that they took delivery of, and they discovered the flight termination system, which is basically like a plug-in device into the flight computer. And that flight computer sits between the captain and the co-pilot on the floor. So I say it's about as easy as putting a USB port in your laptops. That's how easy it is. And so they actually, when they discovered that, they sued the Boeing company, because that meant that anybody sitting in the United States could actually key in to an aircraft. And now I bet you're thinking about MH370, because everyone's mind goes there, because mine did. And by the way, MH370 had just enough fuel on board to go to Diego Garcia, which is a big drone base. And these aircraft can be taken over by an AWACS aircraft, or just about anybody that's running a drone base out of Diego Garcia could have done that. The 7th Fleet was in a drill that day in the South China Sea as well. So pretty sure that's what happened. There were some people on board that had some information that somebody's government wanted, whether it was us or Israel or the UK. It's a joint drone base, actually, with the United States and Great Britain. It's Diego Garcia.
But that's a huge security risk. You talked about that, of having the ability to a termination system like that and transponders on the plane, which is, of course, would be, you'd think, dragged up into the open, and investigations would have to be made here to see that no other planes has these kinds of issues. But we've heard nothing about this.
Yeah, it's interesting. I mean, the companies that bought into it did so willingly because they were sold in the event that a hijacker took over the cockpit, we can land the plane remotely. Well, so what happens? The planes on 9/11 were taken over remotely by using the flight termination system. Since then, in 2006 or 2008, Boeing has come up with their own patent for their own device to do this, and George W. Bush made it mandatory that it's on all U.S. carriers. I don't know what's going on with the U.K. or EU or those European governments, but you could look into that in your country. But yeah, Boeing has a new system that took the place of the flight termination system, does the same thing. And I'm being told that eventually air traffic controllers will be able to control the aircraft and land them somewhere from the actual air traffic control centers. So my question was, when they said we can remotely land the aircraft, I said, who are we? Yeah. And I never got an answer to that. Well, who would we be? Because who are those people that could actually land the aircraft? Well, I think we figured it out on 9/11. So what we have here on 9/11, again, one of the first things that Betty Ong, she's the flight attendant from Flight 11, said is, we can't call the cockpit. We can't communicate with the cockpit. And that, again, showed me that the flight termination system had taken over. When it does that, the air traffic controllers lose the transponder on radar. It takes over the same frequency that the transponder used. And it also, it sort of piggybacks over all communication systems. So the pilots cannot communicate with the company, the air traffic control, or other airplanes using any radio frequency that they have. So that's basically what was going on. And one of the reasons the flight attendants, including Betty Ong, who said, I don't know, but we might be being hijacked. When there's a hijacker on board, you know it. He's usually standing in the aisle, and he's usually with a flight attendant that he's got a box cutter, a knife, or a gun, or a bomb, or, and he's making a demand. Yeah. I want X, Y, and Z to happen. And so there is no doubt. And when she said, I don't know, that told me a lot. And then it told me also that it wasn't a typical hijacking. We might be being hijacked is exactly what she said. And so, again, I heard her tell me a clue that she didn't know. And if you are in a hijacking, you know about it. And there was something else that I found later on, and Betty Ong said this as well, but a lot of the callers did. They said, we're in the air. And I think that they said that because, of course, a hijacking only takes place in the air. If somebody came on board when you were at the terminal on the tarmac, at the gate area, or even taxiing out and said, I want to hijack this airplane, I want blah, 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 you just blow a chute and get all the people out. And so there is no hijacking on the ground. Of course, a hijacking only takes place in the air. And the fact that she said that, it made me realize that a lot of the other callers were saying that too. And they were trying to convince us that they were, in fact, in the air when they were in a hangar.
And so they were knowingly saying this, and they were talking, they knew that they were.
Yes.
So that means, that implies, of course, that they're part of it. And then back to my original question on that, why make these mistakes along the way?
What we believe, and collectively, and we, the American flight attendants and pilots that have come forward, we've had some great chats about this. We believe that the handlers told the pilots and the flight attendant crew that they were part of a training drill. And that you'll notice that until you get to Flight 93, just two people were taken off each aircraft. And I believe they were removed. And when Betty Ong says there was pepper spray or mace sprayed, there was some other gas sprayed. And I think when they removed the people to make the phone calls, which was two off of each aircraft until Flight 93, they were taken upstairs to an office, and that Betty Ong and Amy Sweeney were actually sitting in different rooms. And that's why one was saying that a doctor and a nurse were tending to 9B who had been stabbed. And the other one was saying there was no doctor or nurse on board. And so there were so many things about those two flight attendants, because they were flight attendants and because they didn't say the most important thing that they could have said had they made a phone call. And that would have been how somebody got into the cockpit, because that's what we would have prevented and fixed in the future. And that's how the FAA functioned. If you got in by kicking the doorknob in, then that would be the important thing for them to say. And if you got in by using a credit card to swipe the lock or something, there has to be a method. How did they get in? The how they got into the cockpit was really the only important information, and neither one of them gave that information. They gave us that 9B was the hijacker, then they gave us that 9B was stabbed, and then they said conflicting things. Betty Ong said she was seated at the jump seat in 3R. Amy Sweeney said they were seated together in the second to the last row in coach. And so their messages were completely conflicting, which made me realize that they had been removed from the aircraft. And when they removed the two callers that were necessary to make phone calls, because without the phone calls, we wouldn't have any wars going on right now. The phone calls were the most important for the perpetrators of this event. And so the things that they said, Now, I've been around for a long time. I was a flight attendant for almost 30 years and a purser. And when I flew to places like Amsterdam, which was a big hub from the Europe and the rest of the world into the United States, we'd often have more than 60 languages being spoken. And one of the terminologies that both the passengers and the flight attendants said was they used the terminology, the hijackers were of Middle Eastern descent, and nobody talks like that. And I was like, okay, they're reading this, or they were told what to say. And so I think what happened is, to answer your question, that the aircraft were brought into these hangars at this area. The handlers picked you and you, which in this case was on flight 11, the two flight attendants, you and you, come with me. The gas that they referred to, that neither one of them had a breathing problem in a 27-minute phone call. And gas being sprayed in business class was one of the very first things Betty Ong reported at about 8:19, the very first minute of her call. They took them off into two different offices where they were told to make these phone calls. And more than likely, a cyanide gas canister was thrown in and the door was shut and the people on the aircraft were killed within 3 to 4 minutes. Well, I think what they were told was it's a drill and then we want you to come and make some phone calls. They pulled them into the offices and at that point they were probably a gunshot. They were definitely taken out. They were not part of this. I've got lots of people that were friends with a lot of the crew members. I can't find anybody that looks like they might have been a part of being a handler or being a part of the organization that pulled it off. But we think the only reason that the pilots, because you see all 8 of the pilots were highly trained fighter pilots, military pilots, and what we do, when we put our uniform on, we're there for one thing, that's to keep you safe. Whether we're pilot or flight attendant, we change from being a mom and a sister and the lady next door to being one kick-ass protector of our plane and our passengers. And that's what we do. That's what we drill to do. That's what we are. And the fact that the scenarios that led later on into like Flight 93 were led to believe that the flight attendants did nothing and that they allowed a group of men, by the way, all of those men, the Let's Roll character and the other guys, they all were sitting in different rows of coach talking on the phone up until the minute they claimed the scenario goes that they were going to take over the plane by rushing the cockpit with hot water and coffee pots full of hot water. Well, let me just say this. One, no flight attendant group crew would ever give control in any emergency to untrained passengers. That's what we trained for. We had specific protocols to follow. And so all of them, by the way, were on the phone up until 1 minute before this supposed rush the cockpit. Number two, the aircraft between the captain and the co-pilot is about 2 by 2 foot square box, which is the onboard flight computer, what that flight termination system would be plugged into. Mm-hmm. And it is water sensitive, much like a laptop keyboard. And so when we would hand the captain a cup of coffee, for example, we would have to hand it off over his left shoulder and tell him it's coming in. We would just say, "Captain, your beverage is coming over your left shoulder," where he would turn around and grab it. If we put it over that computer and handed a drink or a beverage, he turned around and hit it with the elbow, or we hit some turbulence and even a tablespoon of liquid bounced onto that computer, then it would not be a pretty picture. So it's something that all flight attendants are trained not to do. And so the fact that we are led to believe that 5 flight attendants on a 757 would allow 4 passengers that didn't even know each other to rush into the cockpit, somehow break the door down and take 4 pots of hot water or coffee in there over that computer is nonsense. Just complete, total nonsense. So these are the kind of things that I saw. And then as I got in there, and now this leads us to these companies, what happens when the flight termination system takes over? And I told you the transponder, this is how the FAA and air traffic control see the plane in the sky. They see that it's American 11. They see the altitude. They see the speed. They see all these different things on these radar screens. Well, as I dug into this, I've discovered there were 2 companies that were in the FAA headquarters in Washington, D.C. for 2 years leading up to 9/11. And one of them was called PTEC, and one of them was called the MITRE, M-I-T-R-E. And interesting things that I'm still discovering to this day about both of those companies. What they were doing, they were actually there to make things appear and disappear on radar for the war games that were going on that day, so that FAA could not see what NORAD showed on their military jets and the NORAD military radar.
So they could simulate it. So basically what was shown to those who are looking at the screens, they think it's real. They think, oh, that this is what's going on, that they're simply reporting on what they see, correct?
That's correct. Yeah. And so they were able to, once the flight termination system took over these four aircraft, they were able to not only make them completely disappear off the screens, but they were able to replace them with a fake scenario of what they wanted you to believe those planes did after they were landed remotely. And so they have a scenario created, which they just uploaded into the computer system. And then later on, they showed you, well, these are the flight paths those planes took. And they even made animated GIF type photos of, you could see the planes moving. And they claimed that Flight 11 and Flight 175 were in a near miss, nearly a collision down by Stewart Air Force Base. But one of the things that's happened since the book came out is I've been privy to and given an external hard drive with a terabyte of FAA and NORAD information, and their official story, it does not exist on radar in text format. So those aircraft actually were not anywhere near Stewart Air Force Base at that time they were claiming. So we're finding some really interesting things, and I'm hoping that it's enough to get the attention of some really big people. Maybe my drone strike. Actually, I'm not the only person. I'm working with a group of people, so they can't silence it. But so what I discovered were these companies, and interestingly enough, that after I did the book, I still kept diving into who the handlers on board might have been. And so I'm looking into those details of those phone calls. And it's very interesting because on the next flight, which also left out of Boston, there were two characters that made phone calls at 8:52. Now, the flight left at 8:14. So at 8:52, interestingly enough, two people, again, just like on Flight 11, at the very exact time the calls were both made, again on Flight 175, at 8:52. And then again at 9 o'clock, there were gentlemen, Peter Hansen, 32-year-old gentleman, passenger, and he calls in at 8:52, and he calls his dad, and he tells his father that an airline hostess had been stabbed. And an airline hostess is not terminology that's ever been used in the United States to talk about a stewardess or a flight attendant, ever. It's a European term, and it's a Middle Eastern term. El Al calls their flight attendants airline hostess. Some Asian companies do. I mean, remember being in Japan and China and being referred to as an airline hostess by a Japanese girl. But it's not an American terminology. We were stewardesses until 1968. And then we became flight attendants because we started hiring so many males in that position. So this guy is, by the way, he is American. He's 32. So his entire lifetime, we have been referred to as a stewardess or a flight attendant. So that was another key that I thought that he either was told to say that or was reading off a card to say that, because it's not terminology that is normally used by an American. But he tells his father at 8:52 that he thinks the hijackers are going to fly them to Chicago, where they will be flown into a building. And prior to 9/11, unless you'd been told the scenario before that phone call, you would never have dreamed that scenario. Then again, he calls his father back at 9 o'clock, exactly 3 minutes before impact, to the South Tower in Manhattan. So 3 minutes before that plane went in, you would know you were over New York City. There's no doubt about it. And so he tells his dad now, this time the stewardess has been stabbed, and that uses the word stewardess. And then he says that they've used pepper spray or mace and that people around him are vomiting and getting sick. And so I thought, well, that's really interesting, because you don't really get sick and vomit from pepper spray or mace, but you do from hydrogen cyanide. So that kind of told me something. And on that same call, there was another gentleman that at first I overlooked this totally. But it's interesting that he calls his mother, first his wife, leaves a call message on her home recorder, then calls his mom at 9 o'clock. This is 3 minutes before impact. Now, keep in mind, New York City is something like 365 square miles. It's huge. So when you're over Manhattan or over New York City, you know where you're at, because it flows into Newark and all of these. It's just huge. And so if you were a pilot, this guy was an F-14 pilot, which is why I at first overlooked him as being a handler. But he tells his mother at 9 o'clock, 3 minutes before impact, that they're over Ohio, he thinks. Now, he's a pilot, so he should be able to tell Manhattan from rural Ohio. And 3 minutes before impact, he would definitely be seeing buildings in New York. So then he also tells his mother that they are thinking, this is now 8 minutes after supposedly the hijacking took place, they, the passengers, are thinking about taking over the cockpit. And that's the scenario from Flight 93 with the hot water. And then I realized that this guy, he also had been told of the scenario. We have Betty Ong saying, we're the first, and she was on the first plane. Then we have Peter Hansen and Brian Sweeney from Flight 175 saying they're going to fly us into a buildings in Chicago, and then we're going to take over the cockpit. And then I realized right then and there that some of these people had definitely been told the entire day scenario, which leads me to answer your question. The people that made these phone calls were told, and the passengers and crew were told they were part of a drill and this was the scenario, and they laid it out for them, and that's the only way they knew those details. However, as I kept digging into Brian Sweeney, his friends in Miramar Top Gun, he's a Top Gun fighter pilot, F-14 fighter pilot, all of his friends, much like 9B, all of his friends said he was 6'2", 225 pounds, he could kill any human being with his bare hands. Why he didn't is the question of the day. As I was researching him after my book came out, I actually was in his online obituaries, and about, as I'm reading through this, a 15 or so obituary comments that people made to his obituary said, I remember you, Brian, from the M cafeteria in the months preceding 9/11 when we worked for the MITRE company, which is one of the companies that we just talked about that was able to make things appear and disappear on radar. And that is basically the shadow government of the United States. And I would venture to say they're in control of most of the world.
And here Rebecca tells you about her website and where you can get a copy of her book.
The website is simply www.methodicalillusion.com. And there you can do a look inside and read the first almost 3 chapters of the book. You can purchase it through any bookstore that can order a book for you. It's in the Ingram list, so it takes about 5 to 7 days to order it if you have a local bookstore you like to visit. I'm available to answer any questions. If you read the book and you want to know, do I have documents to prove this or that, or what's real or what's not, I welcome your questions and will help you proceed in your wake up if you're just having that veil lifted. The thing that I found that's interesting about 9/11, since I was in cognitive dissonance like a lot of people are, and I didn't want to look at it, but once I did, once the veil of 9/11 truth is lifted, you begin to see things like what we just saw happen in Copenhagen and in Paris with the Charlie Hebdo event, and you'll start to see things that are the same type of things. Like on 9/11, we had 2 passports survive, but nothing else. No luggage, no landing gear, no hydraulics, no nothing of the aircraft, but a passport from a hijacker, not from any other passenger, but just the hijacker. And then after the towers, there was one of their passports survived as well in pretty darn good condition. So you'll see in Charlie Hebdo, they also left the driver's license behind in one of the carjacked stolen cars. Mm-hmm. So you'll see the same type of details so that we know who to hate. And that's why the phone calls had to be made on 9/11. They needed to paint the picture of Middle Eastern so that we could go and fight in all those wars that they had planned when they planned and wrote the project for the new American century, which actually called for a new Pearl Harbor event to get the American people on board to go do these 7 or more wars in the Middle East.
And again, you were just listening to an interview with Rebecca Roth, author of the book Methodical Illusion. She was being interviewed by Henrik Palmgren from RedIceRadio.net. I also interviewed Rebecca Roth back in the winter, and that show is available on the website RadioForAll.net. This concludes this edition of 9/11 Wake Up Call. I'm Cheryl. Thanks for listening.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical. Your online antidote to corporate media crap.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next, building bridges.
This is Building Bridges with Ken Nash and Mimi Rosenberg. Walmart workers, fortified with a growing number of allies in their reinvigorated Our Walmart organization, are ready to push the world's largest corporation to pay $15 an hour minimum and provide full-time employment hours for its workers. Our Walmart, which has already won a wage increase for some 500,000 Walmart workers, is on the move along with its new allies, Demos, the Restaurant Opportunity Center, Color of Change, Domestic Workers Alliance, and Jobs with Justice, among others. And they are launching a mass campaign for a $15 an hour wage for all associates and full-time hours for Walmart employees to end, as well, unfair coachings and terminations, and for
Walmart to address racial justice, women's rights, and to address climate change. We are standing up against Walmart because we are fighting for $15 an hour and 40 hours a week, said Wanda Banks, a Walmart worker from Louisiana. If I had $15 an hour and 40 hours a week, I would be able to pay off a lot of my bills. I could sleep better at night without tossing and turning, and have a granddaughter that I need to get through college, so that would help me a great deal and in an awesome way.
We're standing up to Walmart to stop retaliation against workers that speak out, said Janet Sparks, a Walmart worker from Louisiana. So now, our Walmart campaign, with new partners, readies to turn Black Friday into a red letter day in its fight for 15 minimum wage an hour and full-time employment for its employees.
Our Walmart! Our Walmart!
5 years ago, 1,000 Walmart workers came together to launch an independent organization by and for us. We came together because we each decided that Walmart had done enough damage to us, to our communities, and to our country, that we needed to take responsibility for changing Walmart from within. Our Walmart members have risked our livelihoods, put our families on the line to change Walmart. We have told our stories. We have spoken out. We have gone on strikes. We have also engaged in acts of civil disobedience. And we fight not just for ourselves, but with and for all of us. I feel a deep sense of accomplishment. Our members, with your support, are winning change at Walmart. Together we have won a raise for 500,000 associates, which means $1 billion from Walmart into Walmart workers' hands, more hours in our schedule, extended rights for pregnant women. We have given our members the tools to better our stores and make them safer. But my coworkers and I are still struggling. Even as Walmart is profiting, even as the Walton family builds its $144 billion wealth off the work that Walmart workers are doing in their stores, my coworkers, who you will hear from, are still struggling to pay bills even after this year's raises. That's not what should be happening. Our country's largest employer, and it sets its standards. It's not the future we want for our families. It's not the future we want for this company. Our Walmart members have an incredible strength. The strength we gain from coming together makes us all stronger. Together we all, you guys inspire me. Together we all will be stronger. And together we can win 15 and full-time Walmart is the biggest employer in the U.S., the biggest employer of women, of black workers, of Latino workers, LGBTQ workers. All of us need Walmart to change. Changing Walmart will help address racial injustice, the deep challenges we face as women in Walmart, and the company's role in climate change. It gives me a power when we find the ability to speak. No matter how many times this company keeps knocking us down, firing us, and trying to silence us, we keep coming back stronger. Walmart is actually answering to us. Now let's ask for more. Together, we can do this.
Thank you, Evelyn. We're here today for the Our Walmart launch, Changing Walmart Together. What's next for Our Walmart after having raised pay for 500,000 workers across the country? To all the Our Walmart members who are here in the room, you are an inspiration to me and to all of us. Our Walmart leaders, like Evelyn, are standing up to a company that is destroying the livelihoods of working families all across the country and are building an incredible organization. It's an organization inside of Walmart that is actually making substantial change. Nobody believed that this was possible. By taking direct action, by having a bottom-up, digitally savvy organizing model that has made sure that any Walmart worker has a way to get involved, to join, and to participate in the movement for change at Walmart. That's how we've won. Our network now has a reach into over 2,000 stores across the country, everywhere from Paducah, Kentucky, to a store in Idaho, to big areas like Los Angeles. In the past, we've had one organization that was our partner and many, many supporters. But what's so exciting about this moment is we are here today in real partnership with over 20 organizations who are really the leaders out in the world of making deep transformational social and economic change. And we are so excited to be here with you. And we're all here together because for our families and our communities, our struggles are interconnected. We need each other to affect the kind of change that we need to see in this world. Changing Walmart really is the most direct path to dealing with the crisis of income inequality in our country, economic disempowerment of women, people of color in our society, and also for dealing with the catastrophic effects of climate change. 5 years ago, it was hard to imagine that that could be possible. But I think we've all learned from our Walmart members what resiliency and resolve can accomplish. Together, I believe we can accomplish the impossible. We can accomplish transforming Walmart. I'd like to invite up now Lisa Petro and Nikki Bess.
Hi, my name's Lisa Petro, and I'm from Central Florida, Winter Haven, store 968. I'm a very proud Our Walmart member. I joined Our Walmart because we need respect in our stores. Our Walmart is standing for associates everywhere, fighting for dignity, safer working conditions, full-time schedules, better health care options, and of course, better pay. If I made $15 an hour, I'd be able to afford transportation. Right now, I walk back and forth to work early mornings and late nights, be it rain, be it shine, be it daytime, be it night. On one of these walks to work one morning on 4:30 Sunday morning a.m., I was accosted. When I went in to talk to my manager about it, ask him if I could change my availability to not have to walk alone that time of day, he told me he would cut my hours with a smile on his face. I told him I'd rather he cut my hours than somebody cut my throat. I know we can win 15 an hour, and I know Walmart is hearing us. Earlier this year, they announced the raise. We have proven we can win. I work hard. I don't want to have to rely on the government to pay my bills and cover my groceries. I tell my grandchildren to stand up to their bullies, and I think we should stand up to ours.
Venanti from the Pico Rivera store.
Hi, Venanti. The rehiring and not rehiring for the workers, some of the workers that were actually transferred were not members of our Walmart. And the members that we did have at Pico Rivera were not transferred. We did file with the labor board our second. So for us, it's difficult because they're doing rehiring as we speak, but they're not calling any of the members who have spoken out or have been really active. So that tells us that Walmart is retaliating more than what they usually do. Do we think that we're going to get our jobs back? I'm very hopeful, but, you know, it's Walmart, so we don't know. But we're determined. Stand strong with our Walmart. This is just the beginning of our journey to becoming a truly independent organization. With the partnership with all of you, anything is possible. Our work ahead is strength on our foundation and becoming an organization that support and funded for our members, an organization that can support others the way they supported us. And I thank you from the bottom of my heart for all the support as we strive to become the financial independent organization that we'll become.
Hello, everyone. My name is Jasmine Dixon. I live in Denver, Colorado, and I work at store number 3533. I started working for Walmart about 3 years ago. Eventually, I became pregnant. I went to the doctor, and the doctor told me I was high-risk pregnancy because of my asthma and other problems that I have, health issues. After doctors confirmed my pregnancy, I immediately notified my managers and asked to be switched back to day shift. My managers told me that it would take time for them to find a position for me. They didn't tell me a time frame. They just said, we don't know how long it could take. And my first thought was, okay, all these positions in this store, and there's not one single position that I could go back to. And I even offered to open up my availability. I offered anything. I'll go to wherever as long as they can accommodate me being a pregnant woman. It was hard for me to be up all night and to also be a mom during the day while being pregnant. I asked to get a leave and Walmart denied it. Even though my doctor had put me on bed rest because of complications with my pregnancy, I eventually just was fed up and I just quit. I couldn't take it anymore. I was really, really sick. I couldn't even stay awake. During lunchtime, they would find me like sleep in the bathroom. It was just horrible. I couldn't even keep my eyes open, and they still continued to make me lift things that were too heavy for me. Eventually, I gave up hope. I didn't know what else to do. I didn't know how I was going to feed my child. I didn't know how I was going to pay for a roof over our head. After I had my baby, I was still out of work for some time because my son was hospitalized 2 times for some of the health issues that he has. I turned to Walmart to see if there was something that they could do to try to help me, so that way I could keep a roof over our heads and I'll still be able to take care of my kids. A short time later, I was rehired at another store for less pay than what I was making at my first store. So now I'm currently working in the Vision Center. I joined Respect the Bump, the Our Walmart group for pregnant women who are supporting each other and fighting for change. I joined not only to stand up for me, but for others who are afraid to stand up for respect. Not only as an associate, but as a human being. Together, we have succeeded in getting Walmart to improve their pregnancy policy, but it's still not enough, and I will continue to fight for Walmart changes. Woo!
Today's a celebration, right? Good afternoon, everyone. Really glad to be here. My name is Celeste Faison. I'm the Black Organizing Coordinator with National Domestic Workers Alliance, and I'm a part of Black Lives Matter in Oakland. I just really wanted to give some context as to why this moment is important for the larger movement that's happening right now for Black lives. State violence is the murder of Black and brown bodies by police and vigilantes that murder with impunity. State violence is a government giving tax breaks and incentives to major corporations that creates policies and cultivates environments that purposely disempower workers. State violence is those corporations having board members that are now elected officials. So those elected officials then passing laws to make sure that even though those corporations are doing their best to pay the workers as little as possible, they are funding elected officials to make sure that those workers don't get rights and don't have access to government programs to supplement what they need. State violence is any entity that's supported by the government that prevents a worker from being able to feed, clothe, and house themselves. State violence is the war on Black people. State violence is Walmart, the largest employer of Black people in this country. State violence is Walmart closing small businesses in towns, becoming the main employers of the folks in that town, and then enslaving them with poor wages and not giving health care. But let me tell you what a revolution looks like. It looks like the people in this room. It looks like Jasmine. It looks like people standing up when Jamal Crawford was killed in Walmart. Revolution is the fact that when Black women in labor organize, they have a 90% success rate. So we know that the women in this room who are organizing are going to be the ones that lead us to this new economy that we're all fighting for. And for that, we are in deep gratitude and we say thank you in advance. And in Yoruba, we say ashe to that, ashe.
Ashe to that, ashe.
We know that this fight is going to be long, but we know that this fight is not just for the workers of Walmart, but it's for the domestic workers that are also fighting, for the restaurant workers that are also fighting, for all the Black folks who are underemployed in this country and not employed at all. So we are here to support as Black Lives Matter and as the National Domestic Workers Alliance, and we're ready for the fight.
Now we're going to talk about what's next. We know what we've done. We know where we're going, what our shared vision is, and the partners with whom we're doing it. What do we have to do to show Walmart that our Walmart is growing stronger and building for action? So Tiffany Faulkner and Becky Bond, thank you.
Workers across the country have come together and decided we want to do something a little different this year. We're not going to say what. But we definitely want to make it bigger, better, different than we have in the past. And we want Walmart to know that every worker matters. Whether it's someone that just started, somebody that's worked there for a long time, someone that's somewhere in the middle, whether you're a current worker or former worker that have stood up for the fight and has been terminated, we're going to let Walmart know that everyone matters, no matter what level they are, no matter what race they are. We are going to make a difference, and we're going to continue to fight for 15 a full time. 10 was a start, but that's not enough, and every worker matters. So we've had some time sitting in here in this room with a bunch of allies and workers, you know, planning and thinking about what we're going to do for Black Friday. And I just want to take this opportunity to acknowledge all of our allies that are in this room with us today. So right now I'm going to swing it to Becky Bond from Credo.
I'm so happy to be here with Tiffany, and have just spent the day strategizing with her and the other all our Walmart workers. And the names of these allies on this list, they're not just people that are going to, they're going to meetings. These are people that are going to come out, and we're going to back the our Walmart workers. We're going to be there for you. I'm here to tell you that progressives want to stand with our Walmart workers, And they're just waiting to be asked. And that's my job. And that's our job as allies. Credo, well, we're organizers of 3.8 million progressives across the country. And it's our job to ask them to engage in action to back up the Our Walmart members. And that's exactly what we're going to do. In the last 2.5 years, we've done this. And we're going to do more as we go forward. In the last 2.5 years, we've gathered over 650,000 signatures on behalf of Our Walmart campaigns. These are progressives from across the country. They're speaking out for higher wages, for full-time work, and for consistent schedules, and from freedom from retaliation. We've also been there for you on Black Friday, and we're going to be there for you this Black Friday. In past years, when you've been out in front of your stores, our members have been calling, thousands of them have been calling Walmart HQ, so that the people in Arkansas at HQ, they're hearing from people on the phone every time they pick up the phone, just like the manager of your store are going to see you out there every time they look out the window. Our members are going to support you with their money to support our Walmart campaigns. And I'm here to tell you we're ready to double down. We're going to ask them to support you in the future. And that's just Credo. That's just one partner. We have a room full of allies. Your courage is so inspiring. Your work is essential. When you're going to be out there fighting this fight, we're going to have your back. We'll be there.
Thank you.
Who's Walmart?
I'm with two very strong Walmart women workers at this relaunching of the Our Walmart campaign. Venancy and Jasmine. Venancy, let's start with you. You're at the Pico Rivera store in Los Angeles, which we've heard so much about, and we still want to know what's been happening there. So tell us the story there and what's been happening now in terms of union supporters and whether they're going to get their jobs back.
Well, our store closed without us knowing. They gave us a five-hour notice. It was something that nobody expected, which was one of the stores that first went on strike, first did a sit-down, the most active in our country and the strongest one. We know that Walmart is reopening their doors at the end of October, beginning of November. There's no guarantees that we're going to get our job bags. We're fighting. We filed the ULP with the labor board, our second ULP for workers that are part of the organization and have not been transferred and are retaliating against them. So we know that at this point Walmart is hiring, and they have not called any of the associates that were never transferred. We just got a letter saying it's going to open, reapply, but that's not what we're asking. We're asking to be reinstated so that our time in there, we don't become a part-timer. We become a full-timer. Anybody that was part of our Walmart was basically not being called back to work, or it's being retaliated because of Walmart.
And Jasmine, you had a very moving story also. First of all, where do you work?
I work in Denver, Colorado at store number 3533.
Okay, so why don't you retell us your story? It was really powerful.
So I started at store number 2752 about 3 years ago, working as a cashier. A little bit after that, I just came to a conclusion that the money I was making wasn't enough to feed me or my son. Shortly after that, I found out I was pregnant with my second child. The doctor told me I was high-risk pregnancy and that I would need to be accommodated and I would need to stay off my feet as much as possible. I immediately notified my managers about the situation. The first thing they told me was, basically, there's no positions open in day shift, so there's no way that they could switch me to day shift right away. They don't know how long it's going to take. So I had a really hard time working overnight. I would fall asleep. I'd fall asleep in the bathroom. I'd fall asleep in the break room in my car. I had a really hard time staying awake. I was really, really sick. I talked a little bit more to my manager and told her, you know, I can't do this. Something's got to give. You got to help me out here a little bit, you know. It's hard for me to work at night and still go home and be a mom to my son. A little bit after that, I was forced to take an early leave because I couldn't do it anymore. I was going through the most. My doctor told me, you know, you cannot be working overnight. You need to be sleeping, you need to be resting, and you need to stay off your feet as much as possible. They totally ignored that. They sent me on the runaround. They told me, call this number, call that number, talk to this person, talk to that person. Nobody was returning my calls. Nobody approved any of my leaves, anything, and they still basically neglected me. They basically just pushed me off, put me on the back burner. They didn't help me out with anything. So eventually, after I had my son, I was still off work for a little bit. My son was in the hospital, and I was rehired at another store. So now I work at 3533 in the Vision Center, and basically I'm just here, you know, standing up for myself and standing up for other people.
What did you earn before this happened, or what are you earning now?
So before I was earning $10, and now I'm at like $9.85.
And Venancia, we've all heard about the wage increases at Walmart. Tell us what's going on there, and tell us a little bit about it from your own personal standpoint, what you were earning, what you're earning now, what people around you are doing. And what do you do at the store?
I was a department manager for the deli. I was making $14.40, and that's being there for 8 years. The increase that Walmart gave, if you actually break it down, they only gave them like a 15-cent raise to a 10-cent raise if you break it down to the way they're doing things. So they really didn't get a big raise like Walmart is putting it out there, because if you break it down, it actually came out to like either 5 cents, 7 cents, and it's all over the internet on Facebook where, you know, Walmart associates are posting on Facebook where, you know, how is that possible? Why are we only getting a 7 cents raise when we work so hard for this company?
So in addition to maternity and paternity benefits, what do you want Walmart to be doing for yourself and for other, quote, associates, end quote? I love that term.
So basically, I would just want Walmart to give these pregnant women the correct accommodations that they need. Also, I would like to see some type of maternity leave pay. You know, if a woman's high-risk pregnancy, she should be able to take off and not be threatened to be fired for her attendance. I think that they should take into consideration doctor's note, and I think they should also take into consideration fathers that are dealing with high-risk pregnancies or fathers that need to take off for maternity leave also. I think dads should also get maternity leave.
And in addition to that, what do we want from Walmart in terms of wages, working conditions, union rights, and so many other things?
I think Walmart needs to realize that the cost of living has gone up and that they should raise the minimum wage on their side. So we're asking Walmart to pay their associates $15 with consistently full time, not just give them the $15 an hour and cut their hours like they usually do. So we're calling on Walmart to do the right thing for these associates, because without them and without the consumer, there is no Walmart. Our Walmart is not a union. It's an independent organization. And, you know, as much as Walmart want to say that we're a union, we're not. We're a group of associates trying to make Walmart a better place.
Okay, and also now there has been a lot of changes at all. Our Walmart, this was a relaunch today. You want to talk about that?
We're just working on, you know, getting that 15 an hour in full time. We're working towards making some plans for Black Friday. We just want to make Walmart a better company in general. We want to make sure that they're following the pregnancy accommodations, not only for high-risk pregnancy, but also for just pregnant women in general. Also, we want to see a little bit more of sick time, hour changes. We want to see them working with single parents, single moms, single dads, working with them so that they could get the appropriate hours they need to also provide for their family and also be there to take care of their kids, pick up their kids from school, whatever the case may be.
Do you have anything to add to that, and especially in terms of whether this Black Friday will be different from last year's Black Friday?
I think now that our Walmart is independent and it has its allies supporting us 100%, I think this Black Friday is going to be more amazing and more powerful, because we have surprises coming up that, you know, Walmart doesn't expect from us. And, you know, that's something that we're going to keep very uptight and secret until the day of Black Friday. And I hope everybody joins us that day. When you see the Walmart workers outside on the picket line, you know, support them. We would love for you guys to support us on Black Friday. Do not shop at Walmart. Boycott Walmart that day and show the support for the Walmart workers.
Okay, and thank you so much for talking to Venancia Luna from the Plica Rivera store of Walmart in Los Angeles. And I hope we get your job back there. And we're talking to Jasmine Dixon from Denver, Colorado. Got to get out there one day. Thank you so much. Good luck to both of you.
Thank you very much for your support.
Our Walmart campaign with new partners that readies to turn Black Friday into a red letter day in its fight for $15 an hour minimum wage and full-time employment for the Walmart employees. Well, this has been Building Bridges, your community and labor report with Mimi Rosenberg.
And Ken Nash. And log on to our website at www.buildingbridgesradio.org.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next.
This Way Out.
We equally reject new rights that are contrary to our values, norms, traditions, and beliefs. We are not gay.
I believe there should not be any criminal prosecution or infringement of people's rights on the basis of their sexual orientation. We don't have that.
We need to know our history, not have it tamed down and prettified like they're trying to do with Martin Luther King, or even erased as though we never existed.
Welcome to This Way Out, the international LGBT radio magazine. I'm Greg Gordon. Barry blasphemy charges follow a gay couple's Hindu cleansing, Mugabe and Putin misstate the obvious, and a Stonewall veteran keeps the spirit alive. Those stories and more this week because you've discovered This Way Out.
I'm Kristen Million.
And I'm John Dyer V.
With NewsWrap, a summary of some of the news in or affecting LGBT communities around the world for the week ending October 3rd, 2015. An executive at the Four Seasons Resort on the Indonesian island of Bali is facing blasphemy charges for allowing a gay couple to hold a Hindu ceremony at the hotel. The story was widely reported as a gay wedding, but it was in fact a melukat, or Balinese karma cleansing ceremony. That explains the Hindu holy man in photos with a gay male Westerner and his local boyfriend. A police spokesman told Australia's News.com that 36-year-old Ni Niuman Mulyani is under investigation for selling the hotel's Hindu ritual package to the two men, even though she knew they were a gay couple. We have questioned some of the Hindu experts and found that the Hindu religion does not acknowledge same-sex couples, he said. The sales executive already knew the cleansing ceremony would be carried out by a gay couple, so it was a religious blasphemy. Bali is a popular wedding destination for Westerners, but Indonesian law defines civil marriage as exclusively heterosexual. The luxury five-star resort reportedly denied the same couple a wedding ceremony at the hotel in December last year, and the hotel's PR department issued an apology to Hindus this week for allowing the gay couple's cleansing ceremony. Blasphemy convictions in Indonesia, home to the world's largest Muslim population, carry a penalty of up to 5 years in prison.
The Isle of Man's government announced its support this week for a public consultation on a bill to open civil marriage to lesbian and gay couples. Same-gender couples in the autonomous British Crown Dependency have been able to enter into civil partnerships since April 2011. The Isle of Man only decriminalized homosexuality in 1992. Chief Minister Alan Bell told ITV that the island has come a long way since the dark days of the 1990s, and embracing this legislation would reflect our position as a progressive society that takes seriously the rights of vulnerable people and minorities. I believe that values of fairness and tolerance, he said, are shared by the overwhelming majority of people in our island. Following a favorable public consultation, which pundits say will be launched later this month, a civil marriage bill could be introduced in Parliament sometime next year.
There's a deep divide on the issue in Bermuda, according to the local Royal Gazette, but a first step may have been taken this week on the road to civil marriage equality there. More than 200 people packed an auditorium in the self-governing British Overseas Territory for a forum about opening civil marriage to gay and lesbian couples. It was organized by Community and Culture Minister Patricia Gordon Pamplin, who praised the respectful dialogue. Most of the civil marriage equality opponents cited religious reasons, while some on the other side used the speaking opportunity to come out. Linda Meinzer of the Bermuda Public Services Union told the gathering that she's a law-abiding Christian and had always done what had been asked of her. "Now I'm asking something of you," she said. "I want to get married in front of my people, my family, my friends, in a place where I have been raised. I don't want to leave my country to get married." The Gazette reported that her comments brought cheering supporters to their feet. She said she had suppressed who I am for 25 years. Asked when Bermuda's government might take action, however, the minister said only that the gathering had been aimed at starting a community dialogue and that the issue requires careful deliberation.
A marriage proposal on a Beijing subway was the talk of Chinese social media this week because it was a gay man kneeling in front of his boyfriend. Several commuters whipped out their smartphones to record the event, which was greeted with applause by many of the passengers and went viral almost immediately. Thousands have been talking about the proposal on the Twitter-like Weibo service using the hashtag Mid-Autumn Festival Man Proposes to His Boyfriend. On the video, the man is heard to say in his proposal, "Today I invite all the people we know and do not know to bear witness." And yes, so far as we know, the boyfriend said yes, although civil marriage is denied to same-gender couples in China.
In other news, Tunisia's justice minister called this week for repeal of the nation's law against private consensual adult gay sex. Mohamed Salah Ben Aissa was reacting to the highly publicized case of an unnamed 22-year-old student who was recently sentenced to a year in prison for violating Tunisia's sodomy law. He was arrested in early September after his phone number was found on the body of a male murder victim. He denied any involvement in the killing but confessed his relationship with the deceased to explain his connection to him. Authorities accepted his story after reportedly subjecting him to some type of medical examination to prove his homosexuality, although there's no scientific basis for any such exam, which can include a torturous anal probe. Police in the predominantly Muslim nation then handed him over to prosecutors because of his admission to having engaged in gay sex acts. The case has sparked outcry from both national and international human rights groups. Human Rights Watch Deputy Middle East and North Africa Director Eric Goldstein condemned the prosecution, saying that if Tunisia truly aspires to be a regional leader on human rights, it should lead the way in decriminalizing homosexual conduct. Consensual adult gay sex is currently punished in Tunisia by up to 3 years in prison.
New York City Irish LGBT activists have finally won a more than 25-year battle. The Lavender and Green Alliance will be allowed to march in the 254th edition of the city's annual St. Patrick's Day Parade next year under its own banner. The annual Roman Catholic Organization-sponsored event draws more than 1 million tourists each year, but has long refused to allow self-identified LGBT groups to participate. Brendan Fay, founder of the Lavender and Green Alliance, said in a celebratory media statement this week that St. Patrick's Day, March 17, 2016, will be a great day for hospitality and inclusion. Irish Queers, a group that's protested the exclusion for more than 2 decades, also celebrated the decision in a blog post, saying that this is a victory for the grassroots organizing, civil disobedience, and street protest of the Irish Lesbian and Gay Organization and its successor, Irish Queers. An LGBT employee group did march under the NBC Universal corporate banner this year, but reportedly only because NBC was the event's broadcast TV partner. Parade organizers have been under increasing pressure to end the parade's ban on self-identified LGBT participation, with more and more corporate sponsors pulling out or threatening to, and many New York City politicians, most recently Mayor Bill de Blasio, boycotting the parade because of the exclusion. Parade Board Chair John L. Leahy said in his group's media statement that, since 2016 marks the 100th anniversary of the Easter Rising, considered the birth of Irish independence, the St. Patrick's Day Parade, March 17th, is a special opportunity for renewed commitment to Irish values and traditions, and the Irish role in the 21st century. "We are working with the Government of Ireland in this anniversary year," he added, "to teach our young people the lessons of sacrifice and heroism, of love and tolerance embodied in the Irish spirit."
And finally, we bid a belated farewell to a U.S. baseball legend who is also, you may not have known, an LGBT ally. Yogi Berra, for whom the cartoon bear was named, passed away last week at the age of 90. The venerable New York Yankees catcher and perennial all-star was probably best known for his prowess on the field
and his unique use of the English language, such as, "It was like deja vu all over again." But less known were his contributions to the LGBT community. He became an ambassador for Athlete Ally in 2013, a group that partners with professional, college, and Olympic athletes to advance LGBT equality. Under his leadership, the Yogi Berra Museum and Learning Center in Little Falls, New Jersey, presented an exhibit titled Championing Respect, highlighting athletes like Jackie Robinson, who've contributed to social change, and specifically including Billie Jean King and those working for LGBT equality. Center Director Dave Kaplan told the New York Times earlier this year that, "You don't usually see guys like Yogi at gay pride parades, but when I explained to him that this is the equivalent of the civil rights movement, people looking for equal opportunity and respect, he said, 'I have no problem with that. If they can play, they can play.'"
That's News Wrap for the week ending October 3rd, 2015. Produced by Steve Pride, written by Greg Gordon, and recorded at the studios of KPFK Los Angeles.
Follow the news in your area and around the world. An informed community is a strong community.
News Wrap from This Way Out is brought to you by you.
Help keep us on the air and in your ears at thiswayout.org, where you can also read the text of this newscast. For This Way Out, I'm Kristen Million.
And I'm John Dyer V.
It's always Stonewall time, and that's a reason to sing later in the program.
Up behind the bus stop in the toilets of the street, there are traces of a killing on the floor beneath your feet. Mixed in with the piss and beer are bloodstains on the floor from the boy who got his head kicked in a night or two before.
Homophobia, the worst disease. You can't love who you want to love in times like these. Homophobia, the worst disease. You can't love who you want to love in times like these.
The presidents of two countries doubled down on their homophobia and denials this week. Zimbabwe's President Robert Mugabe has chalked up an infamous record of anti-gay statements and policies. So his remarks on the subject at this week's United Nations General Assembly meeting were not surprising, though he apparently failed to notice the chuckles from the audience.
Nowhere does the Charter arrogate the right to some to sit in judgment over others. In carrying out this universal obligation, in that regard, we reject the politicization of this important issue and the application of double standards to victimize those who dare think and act independently of the self-anointed prefects of our time. We equally reject attempts to prescribe new rights that are contrary to our values, norms, traditions, and beliefs. We are not gays. Cooperation and respect for each other will advance the cause of human rights worldwide. Confrontation, vilification, and double standards will not.
Russian President Vladimir Putin discussed his country's supposedly unbiased treatment of LGBT people with reporter Charlie Rose in a web-posted outtake from this week's CBS News program 60 Minutes.
In America, the Supreme Court declared it a constitutional right for same-sex marriage. You think that's a good idea?
Well, I think that's not a homogeneous group of people. Some representatives of the non-traditional sexual orientation, for example, are against the adoption of children by such couples. They themselves are against it. So do you think these people are less democratic than those who support child adoption by gay couples? Most likely not. But that's simply their take on the issue. The problem of sexual minorities in Russia had been deliberately exaggerated from the outside for political reasons, I believe, without any good basis.
Okay, help us understand.
Well, I'll explain it for you. It's well known that in four states in America, homosexual orientation as a crime. Whether it's good or bad, we don't know. We know there's the ruling of the Supreme Court, but this problem has not completely disappeared. It's not completely removed from American legislation, but we don't have that.
So you would condemn that?
I definitely condemn that. I believe there should not be any criminal prosecution or any other prosecution or infringement of people's rights on the basis of their race, ethnicity, religious, or sexual orientation. We don't have that. If my memory doesn't fail me, we had Article 120 of the Criminal Code in Soviet Russia, which had prosecutions on the basis of homosexuality. We've abolished all of that. We have no persecution at all. People of non-traditional sexual orientation work, they live in peace, they get promoted, they get state awards for their achievements in science and arts or other areas. I personally have awarded them medals, but we have a ban on gay propaganda aimed at minors. I don't see anything undemocratic in this legal act. I believe we should leave kids in peace. We should give them a chance to grow, help them to realize who they are and decide for themselves. Do they consider themselves a man or a woman, a female, a male? Do they want to live in a normal, natural marriage or a non-traditional one? That's the only thing I wanted to talk about. I don't see here any infringement on the rights of gay people.
So you're saying that as far as you're concerned, there is as much a recognition for gay rights and gay marriage as there is in the United States. That's your position.
We not only recognize, but we ensure their rights. In Russia, there are equal rights for everyone, including for people of non-traditional sexual orientation as well.
The most recent evidence of the kind of equality that reigns in Vladimir Putin's Russia includes a prominent politician's announcement of a new multinational organization committed to ridding the world of LGBT people and the banning of five LGBT online youth groups. But one of those groups, Children 404, found a way to survive and now has more active members than ever. While the truth and fiction of the Stonewall Rebellion has been a hot topic lately, a proposal to honor the actual historic site is gaining steam. Gay USA TV co-host Andy Hum attended a recent press conference on the plan and told co-host Ann Northrup what happened when an original Stonewall activist went Stonewall.
There is this big movement that was started by something, a private group called the National Parks Conservation Association. We have their website because they've got a petition to the president to make Stonewall, the area outside Stonewall, primarily...
Outside the Stonewall Bar.
Yeah, primarily the park, Christopher Park, a little vest pocket park there, a national monument. They want the president to use the Antiquities Act to declare it a national monument. Now... Kirsten Gillibrand, the senator from New York, Jerry Nadler, the congressman, they're introducing legislation in the Congress to do this because that's the other way to do it. I heard this referred to on the news as the only way to do it. That's not true. The president can do it, and you can sign the petition at their website, ncpa.org. Martha Shelley, who was a Stonewall participant, now there's this press conference with all these officials, and she gives this radical speech linking all the issues. It was eye-popping, and it was totally appropriate for the occasion. I mean, why bother remembering the Stonewall if you're not going to keep its spirit alive?
Exactly.
I'm Martha Shelley, and I was one of the founders of Gay Liberation Front. We're in at the Stonewall Inn today because of the riot that took place around these premises back in 1969. Before then, gay people had to keep the most central part of our souls hidden in shame. And now we might have a national park celebrating our struggles. This is terribly important because we need to know our history, not have it tamed down and prettified like they're trying to do with Martin Luther King, or even erased as though we never existed. So here's some of that history. The Stonewall Riot wasn't the first of its kind. The first that I know of occurred in 1966 at Compton's Cafeteria in San Francisco. What's special about Stonewall is that some of us seized the opportunity to form the GLF, the National Gay Liberation Front. Up to 1969, the existing gay organizations were assimilationist. They aimed to convince America that all gays wanted was acceptance into middle-class society. They were well-dressed and polite, and they got almost nowhere. GLF was a coalition of radical gays from the mainstream organizations, gay radicals from socialist organizations, and street queens and dykes who'd never been organized before. We forged alliances with other groups that shared our dreams of a just society, like the Black Panthers and the Women's Liberation Movement. At one point, we put together a list of demands. These included the right to control your own body, which meant freedom to engage in consensual sexual activity, reproductive rights for women, freedom to get high, and freedom not to have your ass drafted and shipped to Vietnam. Our demands included an end to racist oppression. They included economic justice. We are here today because the in-your-face tactics of Gay Liberation Front, Gay Activists Alliance, and ACT UP succeeded, at least to a certain extent. We have same-sex marriage. We can now volunteer to have our openly gay asses blown up in the Middle East. America may be on the road to ending the drug war, but every day we read about the cops murdering another unarmed black or Hispanic person and getting away with it. Our jails and prisons have become a vast gulag for poor minorities. Abortion rights are being slashed, and women are still treated like baby-making machines in a lot of this country. Economic inequality is astronomically worse. Ordinary workers have lost their jobs, their homes, and their pensions, while CEO pay is somewhere between 700% and 1,000% greater than it was in 1969. And the filthy rich, I do mean filthy, want us to keep burning fossil fuels so they can pile up more money while the planet goes down. Let's pause for a moment today because we need to celebrate our victories, but only for a moment. And then let's all of us, especially you young people, get out in the streets and organize.
So was there, did the officials say anything?
They laughed nervously while this was being, they kept their smiles on because this was a happy occasion. We're going to make it a park. And Martha was just fierce. She lives in Portland, Oregon now.
Thank you, Martha.
Martha Sherry's blast at a press conference announcing the new Stonewall commemoration proposal was discussed by Andy Hum and Ann Northrup of Free Speech TV's Gay USA. And finally, in this week's installment of The Trials of Clerk Kim Davis, Kentucky Governor Steve Beshear's lawyers have asked a judge to dismiss a lawsuit by the Rowan County official who spent 5 days in jail for refusing to issue marriage licenses to same-gender couples. Court filings called Davis' arguments absurd, forlorn, and obtuse. Davis lost her new BFF when the Vatican disavowed her lawyer's claim that Pope Francis had blessed her efforts in a secret, private meeting. And then what could be the best parody of her story yet took YouTube by storm.
Going to the chapel and we're gonna get married.
I just want you all to know that we are not issuing marriage license today.
Why?
Pending.
What appeal is left?
Pending the appeal in the Sixth Circuit.
What's the appeal in the Sixth Circuit?
Has been denied.
Mm-hmm. Right. The injunction is the order that you're supposed to issue marriage license.
And we're not issuing marriage license.
The Supreme Court denied your stay.
We are not issuing marriage licenses today.
So based on what?
I would ask you all to.
Why are you not issuing marriage licenses today?
Because I'm not.
Under
why?
Whose authority?
Whose authority?
Under God's authority.
Just keep pressing. I married first one husband, then two others, then another one, because I think one man is pretty much like any other one. I've never been too troubled by the dubious legalities of sex outside of marriage or of other trivialities. Yeehaw! But when it comes to icky stuff like homosexuality, I'm always very strident with my Puritan morality. In short, matters biblical and spiritual and Calvinist, I am the very model of a modern fundamentalist.
In short, matters biblical and spiritual and Calvinist, she is a very
for saying no to shrimp is way too much of an impediment. I simply pick the verses that support my ideology and hold on fast and true to my intolerant theology. I'll ride this hobby horse until I'm richer than a sybarite. There'll always be good money in denouncing godless sodomites. I'll put my name as author on some books that I can barely read. And get a show on cable to inform the world what God decreed. My husbands all agree that I know more about what marriage is than five Supreme Court justices whose law my faith disparages. In short, matters biblical and spiritual and Calvinist, I am the very model of a modern fundamentalist.
In short, matters biblical and spiritual and Calvinist, she is the very model of a modern fundamentalist.
Perhaps if I learn what is meant by constitutionality, if I could do my job with requisite impartiality, oh, if I could join in marriage to young men who might be thespians, or issue nuptial licenses to enterprising lesbians. If I could see that love is love, no matter what the sexes are, and understand that gays are just like me and my three exes are. In short, if I could finally get a dose of moral clarity, oh, I'd find out what is meant by the idea of Christian charity. Nah. Till then, I'll flaunt the law and draw my wages from the treasury and grab a photo op with my next husband, Michael Huckabee. Till then, it matters biblical and spiritual and Calvinist. I'm the very model of a modern fundamentalist!
The lyrics for Modern Fundamentalist to the Gilbert and Sullivan tune were written by James F. Trum. The YouTube video starring Rena Strober was produced and arranged by Jeff Hoppner and directed by Richard Kraft. Thanks for tuning in to This Way Out, the international LGBT radio magazine. This week, Kristen Mellion and John Dyer V contributed program material with thanks, as always, to Steve Pride, Chumbawamba, Sly and the Family Stone, the Tom Robinson Band, Survivor, and Reba Stober performed some of the music you heard, and Kim Wilson composed and performed our theme music. This Way Out thanks the Kicking Assets Fund of the Tides Foundation, the Yavanna Foundation, the estate of Christopher David Trentum, our contributing affiliate stations, and you, our listener supporters, for making this program possible. Email tworadio@aol.com or write to us at P.O. Box 1065, Los Angeles, California, 90078, USA. For Associate Producer Lucia Chappelle and all of us at This Way Out, I'm Greg Gordon. Thanks for listening online at thiswayout.org, on iTunes, SoundCloud, and Stitcher, and on KRZA Alamosa, Colorado, WMBR Cambridge, Massachusetts, CJLY Nelson, British Columbia, and more than 200 other stations around the world, including this community radio station. Stay tuned. We'll be right back.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical. Your online antidote to corporate media crap.
Against the grain, are the rich wealth creators, as we commonly hear? Should we be grateful to investors and entrepreneurs, as they like to be called, for generating jobs and greasing the wheels of the economy? Or is the source of their massive wealth the rest of us? I'm Sasha Lilly. I'll speak with scholar Andrew Sayer about rentier capitalists and why we can no longer afford the rich. That's following these news headlines.
Good afternoon. It's Gabriela Castellan with headlines from the KPFA newsroom. Army General John Campbell, the American commander of international forces in Afghanistan, said today the deadly airstrike that hit a hospital in the Afghan city of Kunduz was a mistake made within the U.S. chain of command. Campbell also made clear he favored a rethink of a plan to withdraw almost all U.S. troops by the end of next year. He said rising threats in Afghanistan from the Islamic State and Al-Qaeda were among factors informing his recommendations to the White House on future troop levels. Senate Majority Leader John McCain questioned Campbell about the worsening conditions today at a hearing on the Afghanistan situation before the Senate Armed Services Committee.
Do the conditions on the ground warrant a change to the current plan that calls for by the end of 2016 we'd be an embassy-centric force?
So again, based on conditions on the ground, based on the transitions I've talked about, I do believe that we have to provide our senior leadership options different than the current plan that we're going with. Absolutely.
The U.S. Department of Defense is investigating the deadly airstrike that hit a hospital in the Afghan city of Kunduz. The White House said today, noting President Barack Obama expects steps will be taken to prevent such an incident from reoccurring. U.S. Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell said today there were a number of troubling parts to the deal for a sweeping Pacific Free Trade Pact, but senators were still examining the agreement reached by 12 countries. We're in the process, all of us, of reading the Trans-Pacific Partnership Agreement. I don't have any observations to make, only that there are a number of troubling parts of it that we're all taking a look at, McConnell told reporters today in the Capitol. Deep waters may complicate efforts to find out what happened to a U.S. container ship lost at sea during Hurricane Joaquin, a federal safety investigator said today, as a search and rescue mission for 32 missing crews stretched into a sixth day. Missing crew members. A National Transportation Safety Board team headed for Jacksonville, Florida, where the El Faro departed from last week en route to San Juan, Puerto Rico. The ship disappeared in what maritime experts have called the worst cargo shipping disaster involving a U.S.-flagged vessel in more than 30 years. Lori Bobolot, whose daughter was on board, read the last email she received from her.
Not sure if you've been following the weather at all, but there is a hurricane out here, and we are heading straight into it, Category 3. Last we checked, winds are super bad and seas are not great. Love to everyone.
On Monday, ship owner Tote Incorporated said the vessel was undergoing engine room work before it sank off the Bahamas. The U.S. Coast Guard said the body of one presumed crew member was recovered. The Coast Guard is still searching for the others who were on board the El Faro. The ship was crewed by 28 U.S. citizens as well as five Polish nationals who were members of a so-called riding gang commonly hired to perform repairs and maintenance. Captain Mark Fedor is with the U.S. Coast Guard.
If the vessel did sink on Thursday and that crew was able to abandon ship, they would have been abandoning ship into a Category 4 hurricane.
Authorities say another dam has failed in the Columbia area as historic flooding continues throughout South Carolina. Several dams have failed in recent days. The flooding in South Carolina has claimed another life. Authorities say an 82-year-old man who had been missing has been found dead in his vehicle in Columbia. They say the man's car had been underwater in a residential area north of downtown. State officials say there have been 11 weather-related deaths in South Carolina and two in North Carolina. A science writer for Climate Central draws the connection between global warming and the deluge. Andrew Friedman writes for Mashable, quote, "The epic amount of rain that led to deadly catastrophic flooding across large parts of South Carolina and North Carolina is an example of exactly the type of supercharged storm system climate scientists have been warning about for years as a likely consequence of global warming." End quote. Republican presidential candidate Donald Trump told CNN this morning that he's going to stay in the race despite the fact that his poll numbers are dropping.
I'm not going anywhere, okay? I mean, I'll answer it a little bit differently. I gave a very honest answer. I said, look, if for some reason I had no chance and I collapsed, and they take that as saying, oh, maybe there's a little weakness in Trump in terms of the answer. There's no weakness. I'm not going anywhere. I'm leading every poll, and I'm gonna win.
This is Gabriela Castellan. We'll have more details on these and other stories this evening at 6 p.m. on the Pacifica Evening News. Please join us then.
Studios of KPFA in Berkeley, California. This is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. I'm Sasha Lilly. The world's richest 85 people own as much as the poorest half of the world's population. That is, as much as 3.5 billion people. 46% of the world's wealth is owned by just 1% of the population. In the United States, the top 1% owns 35% of the nation's wealth, while the bottom 40% owns just 0.2%. Yet, as Andrew Sayer asserts, it's not a mystery how the rich have become so rich. My guest today argues that despite their self-description as wealth creators, the rich are in fact wealth extractors. In his book, Why We Can't Afford the Rich, published by the University of Chicago Press, Sayer argues that the richer people are, the more their wealth comes from purely unearned sources, from property and finance, not to mention production. His other books include The Moral Significance of Class, and he teaches social theory and political economy at the University of Lancaster. And he joins me now from the UK. Andrew Sayer, let me start by asking you, if you will, to describe the degree of inequality in our respective countries, that is, the US and the UK.
Actually, the US and the UK have some similarities here. And as Thomas Piketty and Emmanuel Sayers and people like that have shown over the last century, there's been a dramatic series of changes in the degree of inequality, especially as regards the rich and super rich. And at the one century ago, just after the First World War, the top 1% received about 20% or nearly 20% of total income. That fell in the interwar period, and in the UK fell down to about 6% of total income. But since then, and again in the US it's the same, the rich have bounded back, with the top 1% taking about 12% now of total income, and more of that, more in the US. So the rich have made a huge comeback, and it's largely at the expense of the bottom 99%, but particularly the bottom 90%.
So how do you define the rich? You just used the term the 1%, something that came out of the Occupy movement, but the top 10%, would we consider them rich as well? How do you define the rich?
Well, as regards the UK, looking at the last 100 years, actually the top 1% versus the 99% has been a key dividing line, because whenever the top 1% have enlarged their share of total income, the 99% have lost out. And that's not just, it could have been different. It could have been the top 5% gaining at the expense of the bottom 95%, or something much more complicated. But throughout the last 100 years, at least in the UK, there's been a kind of hinge point around 99%. So I would say definitely the top 1% are the rich, but the amount of variation within the top 1% is, of course, far greater than within anywhere else. I mean, they can be people with multi-billions like Bill Gates, or people who are just getting into the top 1% with incomes, well, in the US, just roughly trying to convert from pounds to dollars, they'd be getting a household income of about $250,000 to $300,000 a year. There's a matter of degree in it. The richer you are, the more of the problem it is, for various reasons, which we can no doubt talk about.
So you've been giving us a rough sense of how we should think about the rich. Who are they? Whether it's as a percentage of the population, whether it is by income or wealth. But I wonder if you could describe for us, who are the rich? Because, of course, the image that we tend to get in the mainstream media is of celebrities, high-flying movie stars, and so on. Are they the rich, or is the rich a broader group than that?
It's not celebrities in the media, like sports stars and television and film stars. Even someone like Steven Spielberg or Oprah Winfrey, they don't really get anywhere near the top. They're certainly super rich, but most of the super rich, we ordinary people haven't heard of. Okay, there are a few exceptions like Bill Gates, of course, and Donald Trump and so on, and Warren Buffett, but most of them are known only to a few business insiders. So in Britain, most people haven't heard of the top 10, and most of them are foreign, Russian and so on, super rich people who control businesses we haven't heard of in many cases. The richer they are, the more their income tends to be associated with finance and real estate, and the more of it is what I would call unearned income. But no doubt we can talk about what that is later.
Sure. One of the things that we've heard about in this country is very high salaries going to people, say, in the medical profession. Mm-hmm. And that is one group of people who are making a substantial amount. But it sounds like what you're saying is that within the spectrum of the rich, those people will say making $400,000, $500,000 a year, although obviously a lot of money, would be dwarfed by people who are on the top echelons of the 1%, so to speak, whose income and more significantly wealth would be substantially more.
Absolutely. Certainly key medical consultants and other people who have very specialist skills, but also power that goes with that, and can leverage for themselves very high salaries. There's no doubt about that. But they tend to be in the bottom half of the top 1%, if you see what I mean. But to get into the top half, you really need other sources of income, like financial securities and the income which they give you, bonds and shares, derivatives and so on, and also property, capital gains and such like. Any Get Rich book will tell you that the best way to get rich is not simply by working hard. In fact, maybe you don't need to work hard. It's by getting access to financial assets, which will yield you lots of unearned income.
Right, and we will be talking a lot more about that. In fact, that's sort of the centerpiece of your book, How Are the Rich Rich? But before we get to that, let me ask you, how do the rich spend their money? Because that has a significant role, not just simply as an individual question, how a certain person may spend the money that they have, but it actually has a societal impact.
Yeah, well, if you're a billionaire, then it's very difficult to spend all your income. At least it is hard to spend it on things which you'll actually get to use in a typical year. For example, you may have four or five houses in different parts of the world, and you're unlikely to be able to stay in any of them for more than short periods. But the more you get, the less you can use them, the less point is in having them. And maybe a couple of private jets would be useful, but any more than that is a complete waste. And likewise, trying to get a bigger yacht than the next billionaire will take several hundred million, perhaps. But if you're a billionaire, that's not making much impression on your wealth. So what they do with most of their wealth is just reinvest it, and they're seeking new sources of further capital gains. They might invest in property, not in order to live, but just to take advantage of the inflation of its value. So once you get into the multi-millions, it becomes harder and harder to spend on things which you'll actually use. In other words, it's money beyond purpose, in a way.
Andrew Sayer is my guest. He's the author of Why We Can't Afford the Rich. You're listening to Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio, and I'm Sasha Lilly. So then the question which you touched on, you mentioned that the rich have not always been as rich as they are now, and that if you look over the 20th century, in the earlier part of the 20th century, the rich were quite rich. That then changed mid-century and then has become concentrated again at the end of the 20th century and into the 21st century. So can you tell us then why the rich are as rich as they are now? What has happened?
In the 1920s, the interwar period, labor grew in strength. The political enfranchisement of labor meant that it had more influence. It was more possible to tax the rich and to reduce their share, huge share of national income, and also to reduce their wealth. And particularly with the New Deal and the Second World War, that changed economies and changed attitudes as well. So for people to sacrifice themselves for the country in the war, they expected a better life when they returned from the war. And the shift in power towards labor, particularly with the Reconstruction after the war, made a huge difference as well. And we experienced in the UK and in the US in the late 1940s through to the 1960s very high rates of marginal taxation, which young people today would scarcely believe, over 80% and over 90%, even in the US. So very high earners were very highly taxed. And yet capitalism was very successful in that period from the late 40s through to about early 1970s. That was the most successful period of capitalism, in fact. But capitalism also got into trouble in the sense that globalization meant that industry could run away from well-paid labor in countries like ours, to East Asia and so on. That weakened trade unions and labor organization. And also rates of profit in rich countries were also falling in productive industries. And as David Harvey has argued, capital started looking for other outlets, particularly in property and in financial assets. And with the liberalization of finance in the 1970s, that gave them free rein to do so. And so you had a shift away from a kind of productive capitalism after the war, after the Second World War. Starting in the 1970s, late 1970s, towards what I would call a rentier capitalism, in which simply controlling assets is the key way to get income, rather than investing considerably in productive industries.
Well, listeners to this program will be familiar with the critique of neoliberalism, which you've been talking about over the last 40 years, and the characteristics of it, from change in regulation, financialization, a kind of project of what perhaps could be called a class war from above. But one of the things that you stress, Andrew Sayer, in your book, Why We Can't Afford the Rich, which certainly is less stressed in other analyses of neoliberalism, including radical ones, is that a key component actually had to do with the composition of the 1% wealthiest people, and that the wealth became even more concentrated at the top of the 1%. Why is that significant to you in your analysis?
Well, yes. I mean, I agree with lots of other people on the basic features of neoliberalism: marketization, privatization, liberalization of financial markets. The market is the default or optimal form of organization. And also with the kind of cultural changes which your local author, Wendy Brown, has written about.
Sure.
of how we all are expected to become little entrepreneurs of our own lives, looking after our human capital and so on. But I think there's a third thing, which is not simply a shift from labor to capital, but to a different kind of capital, in particular the rise of finance and the way in which getting wealth by controlling assets, as I mentioned earlier, that other people need or which yield streams of unearned income, is seen as the key way to enrich oneself. And that's come to the fore hugely in the last 30 or 40 years, with finance taking up so much more of economies than they used to do. And whereas previously they were primarily a support for productive industry, providing credit, oiling the wheels of industry and so on, and investment, now it's largely a self-serving, extractive sector. It extracts wealth more than it contributes towards the production of wealth.
Well, we will talk more as the hour goes on about capitalists who make their money from finance and who don't. But I want to just zero in on the key argument at the center of your book, which is an argument about how wealth is created. There is a whole set of beliefs, which are very commonly held, that those, certainly in the United States, that those people who are rich because they have earned their money. They are people like Steve Jobs, who have created enormous amounts of money through the brilliance of their own vision, and that the money that they make, therefore, is rightfully earned. You make quite a different argument in the book, which is that we need to think again, in a way that hasn't been done perhaps in centuries, about wealth as the product of extraction. So I wonder if you could contrast those two arguments, one about capitalists as wealth creators, or as the term they like, entrepreneurs, and then capitalists and the wealthy as those extracting wealth.
Well, first of all, what is wealth? It's not simply money. Money is a claim on wealth. Wealth is useful goods and services, at least economic wealth is. And some of them are sold, some of them are not sold. So when you have public schools, free state schools, then wealth is being produced. Useful services are produced by teachers, and they're consumed, as it were, or used. They benefit other people. And that is wealth, as part of wealth. Ordinary people producing or contributing directly or indirectly to the production of useful goods and services are creating wealth. And what money does is give you a claim on wealth that is produced by other people. And most people get their money from wages and salaries for contributing to the production of goods and salaries. And so they're getting something back Whether it's as much as they contribute is another matter, but they do get their pay is conditional upon contributing in directly or indirectly to the production of goods and services. But you can also get money without contributing anything new. If you can get control of some property, say you buy some, you already have a house, but you have some spare cash, you buy up a lot of cheap housing, and you start renting it out to people who can't afford housing, then you're not actually providing anything that didn't already exist. You haven't created anything new. You are using your power in controlling those resources to get unearned income. And there are situations where you can get both earned income, that is income conditional upon producing goods and services, and unearned income, but you can get a bit of both. And chief executive officers may, to some extent, contribute to the provision of goods and services, and they may be quite important for that, and maybe Steve Jobs was, although he didn't do anything on his own. But also simply by virtue of their power, by virtue of the existence of hierarchies and they being the people who happen to be at the top of them, and they may be very good at being at the top of them, they can use that to lever extra income for themselves, which is effectively unearned. It's not in exchange for anything. So someone who controls a firm by virtue of being owner or being a manager is getting paid not only for what they contribute, but simply on the basis of having power, because it's hard to stop them. And as long as in public companies, as long as managers provide shareholders with rising value, share values and good dividends, then they're going to be allowed probably to rake off quite a lot for themselves.
So,
and Steve Jobs and people like that, yes, in some ways may say they're quite admirable, and my criticism is, of them is much less of than it is of people who overwhelmingly get their money and without contributing to production new goods and services. So by contrast, there's a Mexican super billionaire who's sometimes been at the top of the world wealth list, Carlos Slim Helú, who took over the Mexican telecommunications system, and that gave him instant access to what was effectively rent coming from the millions of people who had to use that service. He wasn't actually providing anything new. So that's rather different. But you can get money simply by virtue of power stemming from control of assets. And a big company is an asset. But I would also add, it's always important to remember, and I think some people like Jobs will occasionally recognize this, that they were also the beneficiaries of living in a society with a very highly developed science and infrastructure and education system and so on. And they also couldn't do anything on their own. There are lots of unknown people working for them who made important contributions as well, but who are not in such positions of power to take as much income as he could.
Well, and staying with him, because one of the points that you make in your book is that we should be critical of the rich, not because we want to revile them as individuals, but because structurally there's something very wrong about having this class of people who are able to have the power and wealth that they do. So staying with someone who might be more appealing, like a Steve Jobs, the presumption is if he is getting a much larger slice of earnings than whatever he would have contributed himself, then the presumption is that there are other people who aren't getting that. Is that right? That that if wealth is being transferred to the rich, it's got to come from somewhere. Where does it come from?
Yeah, well, as the neoliberal thinker Milton Friedman said, there's no such thing as a free lunch. And if you do get a free lunch, that is at someone else's expense. So if you're basically living, for example, off rent or capital gains on property, then you're getting free lunches. You're getting something for nothing. And I think we should use that term, that phrase, something for nothing, against the rich rather than against, as it's usually used, against people on welfare. So just as a child can only get a free meal if its parents provide it one with one and do the work of buying it and preparing it and so on, So someone who gets a free meal through inheritance or capital gains or something like that can only get that windfall, that free lunch, if there are other people producing wealth. Because say you get $100,000 of capital gains on some property and you can actually realize that, then you want to spend that. That money only has value if there are goods and services that other people can have produced, which you can buy. And they must be, obviously, goods and services which they themselves can't afford to produce. Otherwise, there wouldn't be any left over for you. So do you see what I mean? That unearned income can only exist if others are producing more than they're getting back in their pay.
So in other words, the majority of people are producing a surplus that then gets transferred upwards.
Yeah.
You're listening to Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. I'm Sasha Lilly. We'll take a music break and be back in a moment with Andrew Sayer. Listening to Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. I'm Sasha Lilly, and today I'm speaking with Andrew Sayer. He's the author of Why We Can't Afford the Rich, published by University of Chicago Press. So one of the key distinctions, and you've touched on it already, is the distinction between earned and unearned income. And I wonder if you could tell us why this term fell out of circulation. It's not a term that we hear in the mainstream media in discussions about the economy, economic crisis, or in even inequality. So when was this distinction more significant, and what happened to it?
Well, it began to be used, I think, in the late 18th century. And right through, it's very common in any writing about politics and economy into the early 20th century, and the so-called ethical socialists like R.H. Tawney and J.A. Hobson would often refer to this, and it continued after the Second World War as well. And in fact, I don't know about in the U.S., but in the U.K., on our tax returns, when we fill them in, we have to distinguish between unearned and earned income. And unearned income embraces capital gains, inheritances, rent. And by rent, I don't mean, you know, paying rent to your landlord to cover maintenance costs. That's perfectly reasonable that you pay for maintenance or pay for towards the original construction costs. It's also interest. Money's rent. Banks create new money to lend out. And the cost of doing so is negligible, but they can charge interest to you on it. And also profit on production, simply by virtue of controlling production, the owner or their delegates, delegate managers, can skim off profit for themselves. This is a form of unearned income just based upon ownership. So with people like Jobs, just to go back to him, Steve Jobs, I mean, you have to ask, well, if they weren't owners or part owners, how much would they get? And one can imagine that normally they get considerably less. But, that distinction is extremely important. Why did it fall out of use? Well, it's hard to explain an absence, of course. But one has to be suspicious with the rise of neoliberalism, increasingly dependent on unearned income, and trying to with the idea of popular capitalism to make it generally part of life. And to some extent in the US, at least with stocks, I understand that quite a lot of ordinary American citizens play the stock market. Well, they are small-time rentiers. They are living off a certain amount of rentier income, although probably not making a huge amount out of it. They're not the big-time ones. But it wasn't in order to appeal to people. The term unearned income was perhaps seen as unappealing. And people like to believe that what they get is what they deserve. And so you can imagine, well, this is very common in Britain. So in a place like London, which has a ridiculous housing market where the house prices are going up 10% to 13% per year, and people get capital gains, and they tend to think, well, they deserve it, so that they've been prudent, or that maybe they're underpaid at work anyway, so it's okay. They're loath to believe that this is something for nothing and at someone else's expense, and in effect it's siphoning off or free riding on other people's work. They're loath to believe that, but then nobody's telling them that. That's why I wanted to write this book, to tell them that actually they are the free riders. So I don't know about any kind of conspiracy, but it is interesting to say the least that over the last 30, 40 years, just at the very time unearned income has started to grow again, the term falls out of use, or the distinction between earned and unearned income falls out of use.
Well, and it's interesting that language does seem to be an issue in perhaps obfuscating some of the distinctions about how the economy actually operates, that there are a number of words which have dual meanings, and that within sort of popular use of language basically gives wealth and power often a pass. You mentioned the term investment and wealth. Why should we be a little careful about how we use these words?
Yes, well, I think the easiest one, there's three. There's earnings, investment, and then wealth. And earnings is the simplest one, and I think some people notice this. When a hedge fund manager or something like that says they've earned so many tens of millions or something like that, or some cases billions, a lot of people will say, oh, yes, earned, or just got, just procured, if you like. And we have two meanings to the word earned in English and in many other languages, apparently, where on the one hand it means what you get from the market. On the other hand, it means what you deserve. If I say I earned that $1,000, I really earned it, that implies that I say it with emphasis, I'm implying that I deserve it. I didn't just get it by virtue of my position. But it is it's an important distinction. And, okay, it's always going to be fuzzy. How much should we get is always going to be a contestable thing. But in many cases, it's perfectly clear that just by controlling a resource or by being the child of a super rich person, getting an inheritance, you're getting something for nothing. And then I think actually the most important of all is the word investment, because it's one of these words which always sounds good. And if you're an investor, it sounds like you're some kind of benefactor, social benefactor, and a very clever, prudent person as well, and some kind of happy conjunction between private self-interest and the public good. But it's actually used in two very different senses. And one, you could call the wealth creation sense, where you actually invest. Well, in the 18th centuries, it might have been canals, and 19th century railways, and so on, and textiles. And now we invest in things which actually produce benefits, like improving broadband systems or something like that. So, or teaching people, training people so they get new skills. That actually creates objective benefits. And then there's a second sense, which is to do with wealth extraction, where it's all looked at from the point of view of the person providing the funding. Whatever brings you a return, a positive return, is an investment, or certainly a good investment. And it doesn't matter whether it produces any objective benefits, any wealth creation or not. You're not concerned with that. If you're a so-called investor on the financial markets, then you don't care whether a billion pounds comes from mere wealth extraction, unearned income, or whether it comes from actually contributing to objective improvements in infrastructure and training and the way we live our lives. So, and that elision, if you like, between those two meanings is extremely important because it allows people to pass off wealth extraction, which merely provides them, say, with some interest on some savings or something like that, as an actual contribution, a form of wealth creation, in fact, in the economy. And that's often not the case. The two can go together, of course. And I think if you do risk some funds in a productive investment, then I can't see anything wrong with getting some share of the benefits of that. But if you're merely using your money, for example, to lend out for someone to buy some existing property, well, you're not actually creating anything new. You're just taking advantage of your strength relative to their weakness and making them pay you for it, give you some unearned income. So that's the second one. Wealth, the third one, I think I effectively explained that earlier, that real economic wealth is actual use values, as political economists call it, goods and services which actually benefit people, whether it's teaching or whether it's cooking or looking after elderly people or producing food or software and so on. And then wealth in the financial sense is a financial or monetary claim upon those goods and services that you can get people to sell you them. And that's quite different.
So in terms of the mechanisms through which wealth is extracted in our societies, you mentioned rents. Then you also write about interest. And there historically has been a long critique of interest, quite a lot of it actually coming out of religion, right, about usury. I wonder if you could talk a bit more about why interest is a problem for society in general.
Yeah. Okay. Well, the amount of interest, the rate of interest makes a difference. If it's only 1% and it's that is real interest rate as take into account inflation, then that's less of a problem than a 10% interest rate or a 20 or a 1,000%, which sometimes with payday lenders you get. So it depends upon the amount, how serious it is. But let me give you a striking, homely analogy, if you like. If you're hard up and you can't pay your bills and you ask a comfortably off friend, can you lend me $1,000 so I can pay my bills? And this friend said, well, yeah, okay, but I'm going to charge you 5% interest, and if you don't pay me back in a given time, I'm going to seize some of your assets equivalent to the value of the loan plus interest. Well, it would be pretty clear to you that that was the end of the friendship, wouldn't it? That this person, this so-called friend, was taking advantage of your weakness. And both the religious and secular critiques of usury boil down basically to that argument that the terrible thing about usury is that it allows the strong to take advantage of the weak. And obviously, as I said, it's a matter of degree. If it's 1% interest, it's not very much. It doesn't really matter much. But if it's many, many, much higher than that, and if it actually impoverishes the debtor and allows the creditor to demand work for them and to dominate them. And we do see modern examples of this, and I actually think the Greek episode recently was an example of the creditors dominating the debtors in a shocking, quite shocking way, which fits totally with the critique of usury. It exemplifies exactly what the critique of usury was getting at. So there's that kind of moral economic argument, which I think is still really important, but also interest is dysfunctional, as Keynes argued, and it's hardly radical. It's a kind of deadweight cost, payment for nothing. And also, What a lot of people don't realize is that private banks create money that they lend out, and they're not actually lending other people's money out who've left deposits in their banks. They're creating money, which is virtually costless. They just write in some, type in some digital, some money into people's accounts, and then they get paid back, but they get paid back with interest.
Can you explain how that works? Because I think a lot of listeners will say, but wait a minute, so banks are creating essentially fictional money that they're lending out. How is that possible?
Well, because they're allowed to do so. And 97% of all money now is digital money. And only about 3% is cash, coins, and bills, and so on. And they do it just by typing. When you take out a mortgage, a loan for a property or something like that, or a car loan, auto loan, what they do is type so many thousand dollars into your account, and you pay that back, but you pay it back with interest. And maybe you're paying back interest over 20, 30 years. And that's quite considerable. And that provides the bank with unearned income, basically. And there are also big questions about lending money against property, which just very often just tends to inflate its value, especially with housing, most particularly. And that has dysfunctional effects as well on economies, that increasing amounts of wealth are just tied up in property instead of being used for productive purposes to produce new things, including new houses. So the banks create money, I think. And initially, central banks were reluctant to acknowledge this, but the Bank of England now acknowledges, and American banks have now acknowledged it. They create money. And I think that's finally out into the public domain at last. And that's a very important power. It's important to be able to create money. If everybody stashes their spare savings under their mattress, then the amount of money in the economy shrinks and the economy suffers. It's important to create money, but how you create it and what you create it for is very important. So in Britain now, with the election to the Labour Party leadership of Jeremy Corbyn, there's a big debate about quantitative easing, which is money creation. And it's been done to benefit the financial sector previously, creating money to help bail out the financial sector. And there's been very little criticism of it. It's just been seen as technically necessary. But Jeremy Corbyn, and many on the left, are arguing that it should be used carefully for supporting important infrastructure investments, which actually provide long-term benefits, especially as regards renewable energy. Creating money is very important in societies, and it's important to have democratic control of it, rather than just leave it on the basis of extremely powerful banks being able to do it wherever it happens to benefit them and increase their power.
Andrew Sayer is my guest. He's Professor of Social Theory and Political Economy at Lancaster University. You're listening to Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. I'm Sasha Lilly, and we're discussing his book, Why We Can't Afford the Rich. That's published by University of Chicago Press. So you've been describing in this hour how the rich, and especially the very rich, draw their wealth from primarily unearned income that takes various different forms. Rents is one, interest is another, production is another one. And there's so much to discuss here, but I wonder if we can turn, because the hour is running down, to talk about something which I think is a key dimension of what you're arguing and why you think this is such an urgent question, which is the environmental impact of the rich. What kind of ecological footprint do the rich leave?
Well, as you get wealthier, you spend more, and not surprisingly, your carbon footprint tends to get bigger. So the richer individuals are, the bigger their carbon footprint. And at a worldwide level, the top 7% of earners, which includes a lot of just well-off, reasonably well-off people in the rich countries, the top 7% of population worldwide are responsible for 50% of emissions, which is also interesting in that we're about 50% over or rather we're double what the Earth can actually absorb in terms of greenhouse gases. So we're producing twice as much in greenhouse gases as the Earth can absorb, but half of what we're producing is produced by that richest 7%. So here it goes beyond the what I previously, earlier in the book, are targeting as the rich and super rich. But the rich are involved not only through their consumption, but through their dependence on unsustainable growth, and in many cases, quite specifically, in their dependence on investments in fossil fuel extraction. So in order, for example, to get repaid your loans and get interest on all the loans that you've made to people into the future, then that really depends upon future growth. The economy's got to grow in order to make that affordable. So that makes it all the more unsustainable, because it's in a very simple point, which I think the Pope made, which is that quite simply, exponential growth in a finite world is an absurdity, and we have to face up to that fact. The idea of green growth, where we can continue to grow but without growing our carbon footprints and so on, is a pipe dream at the moment. Yes, we are managing to produce things with less carbon, but population growth plus increasing consumption is far outstripping the reduction in carbon intensity of the stuff that we consume. So this means that certainly the rich and the super rich have to consume less, but we've got to stop that investment in fossil fuels. And we also need a kind of economy which is not dependent on growth, which doesn't crash immediately. Growth slows up, as it is, as it has done in the last 5 years.
Well, I'd like to ask you more about how you think we could get to that, but let me ask you this question. So you're arguing that we need to be turning toward a kind of steady state economy, that the exponential growth that is characteristic of the societies we live in is not sustainable. One question, though, that comes to my mind is, you were talking earlier about the rich using their wealth in unproductive ways, through rents, for example. But would it be better if they were using them in productive ways, given that that would increase growth?
It's a kind of paradox, isn't it? That on the one hand, I'm saying that they're too rich and they're not spending their money on productive uses, but if they were to spend it more on productive uses, might not that just speed up?
Right.
Yes, it might. It depends how it's spent. And so we really have to have a kind of wartime mobilization of investment in green technology, coupled especially in the short run with a reduction in consumption levels by the rich and super by the rich and the well-off, so that we don't expect to be able to make several long-haul flights per year. We don't expect to have second and third homes and jet skis and other wasteful things like that. We do actually need to do things like eat less meat, because it's extremely inefficient way of producing calories, and also very bad for greenhouse emissions and so on. So this is the world is indeed at a crisis point. And I'm not talking about the economic crisis here. I'm talking about the climate crisis. Because if we tip over beyond 2 degrees Celsius increase, it's almost certain that we'll have runaway global warming, which is impossible to stop. And that is a terrible future for our children and future generations. So it does require very, well, back to basics thinking and drastic measures, and all this to be done very quickly, which is, I know, asking a lot, but things are really serious, and I don't think most people are taking climate change nearly seriously enough. They think that, well, that's a minor problem that can be dealt with on the way, just by getting a little bit better insulation in your house or something like that, or having low energy light bulbs. That's not going to do it. We need drastic action quickly.
Well, let's talk about Since you're saying these things are all tied together, really, the political implications of thinking about how to reduce the power of the rich. You write that certain concrete steps would go a ways toward reining that power in. What would those steps look like?
Well, with rent, I would have kind of land value taxes, which have been advocated not only by the left, but actually by some figures on the right, like Henry George, of course, and even Milton Friedman said a land value tax is the least bad tax. So you tax away those free lunches, if you like, and return them to the public who effectively paid for them. And interest, where interest is concerned, that's tied to credit. I think credit needs to be brought under democratic control to not totally, but to a significant extent, so that it's used for funding necessary productive investment, particularly in the foreseeable future, with a huge emphasis upon sustainable energy, sustainable ways of living. And as regards other forms of unearned income, I think ensuring that employees and users of products and services should be the key stakeholders, not absentee shareholders. I mean, it is absurd that shareholders are the almost the only stakeholder. You know, I can buy some shares in Monsanto or whatever, and the money that I pay doesn't go to Monsanto, it goes to the previous owner of those shares. I'm not invested in the company at all, but I then get a bit of power over what happens to Monsanto if I buy a lot. And I get this unearned income in the form of capital gains by trading shares and dividends and so on. I should not be a stakeholder. It should be the employees and key users or representatives of users. And it's a question of justice, but it's also functional for the economy, that way you're more likely to get an economy which is serving the public rather than providing a kind of disservice. And I think it's very important that with that, people like Gaurav Porovitz have argued, we need much more cooperatively organized economic organizations. So there the workers clearly are the prime stakeholders. And one of the attractive things about them in a no-growth future is that they can survive without constantly expanding. And they can stay at one level. And that would actually probably also mean that there would be less competition, and I think we need less mobility of capital. Competition can be a good thing. It can raise standards and should be retained in many sectors. But there can be competition between competing cooperatives. And internationally, competition, again, is a very mixed bag in terms of its benefits. So we do really need to rethink economies rather than just assuming that business as usual is the only possibility.
Well, I'm afraid we're entirely out of time. Andrew Sayre, thank you so much for your time.
Thank you. I enjoyed it.
I've been speaking with Andrew Sayre. He's the author of Why We Can't Afford the Rich, published by the University of Chicago Press. You can find a link to that book on our website, againstthegrain.org. He teaches social theory and political economy at Lancaster University in the UK. I'm Sasha Lilly. You've been listening to Against the Grain. Thanks for listening. And please tune in again next time. Against the Grain is produced by Sasha Lilly and C.S. Song. Please visit us online at againstthegrain.org, where you'll find on-demand and downloadable audio and a way to sign up for our podcast. And you can check us out on Facebook at Against the Grain Radio or follow us on Twitter at Radio Against.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical. Your online antidote to corporate media crap.